Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, hello. 6 minutes late. I'm so sorry. This is Danielle St. John filling in for Proof of the Proof Negative show. So I'm so sorry about that. My computer decided to not have a good time for the first 6 minutes, but I'm here now. And I think we even have Lily here.
Okay, be quiet.
I assume that was to your kids.
Oh, my God. I'm so sorry. I didn't even know that I was on the actual thing because I didn't press the number one.
Oh, you didn't? Okay,
oh,
I'm
God.
Sorry. Well,
I'm
yeah,
sorry. That's so embarrassing. Let me just yell at you to be quiet.
Yeah, I was like, okay, and we have Lily. Okay, be quiet. I knew you were talking to your kids, but
God, I'm
love,
so
I
sorry. I just
so
heard my name and was like, oh, you guys have to quiet down now.
Yeah. No, I do the same thing to my kids. Actually, my daughter's in the kitchen. I was about to tell her, shut up. But she helped me with the sound. So, yeah, it was an IT glitch. So, but we're here now, and I'm so happy to be filling in for Proof. He's dealing with a couple of health issues. So, but thank you, Lily, for being here. I appreciate it.
Of course. And prayers up for Proof that he feels better soon.
I'm sure he will. And I'm happy and honored to hold down the fort for this show. And do you know that one of his first interviews was Cynthia McKinney, like 12 years ago?
That's amazing. I did not know that.
Yeah, isn't that? Yeah, he's a pretty amazing individual. Okay, so today I'd like to talk about something that's, you know, near and dear to everyone's heart, which is COVID and nearing the end of this journey, so to speak. I really kind of want to get out the lessons that we've learned from COVID and things that we should never let happen again and things that maybe should stick around, right? You know, so that's really the main thing I wanted to talk about. But then Lily was actually brought up a secondary awesome topic, which is the core of the earth slowing down and stopping. So it's such a fascinating topic. I honestly didn't know of how many people around even knew about this topic, that the core of the earth had stopped. So I'm definitely interested to get Lily's take because she's, excellent in all things spiritual and earth. And so in my opinion, anyway, so I'm happy to get into that too. So Mom might actually even come in for a little bit of good news. I hope that we can get her in for some good news, but she's working until 7 o'clock. Anyway, why don't we start with how was your week, Lily? We missed our show this Sunday because I had some stuff going on. And Elizabeth, my co-host, was out. But tell me about your week. How are you doing? You've got some cold weather coming in, right?
Yeah, so I think the cold weather hopefully is over now. It was a bit nicer out today. It's been like negative 20 all week until today. It impedes some of the outside work that I need to do on the RV to get it road ready, and so it's a little frustrating.
Yeah.
But divine timing, I just have to keep reminding myself divine timing.
Exactly. You should do some, you should hatch some eggs, that's what I'm thinking. Because especially if you're going to head out this way, you can brood some eggs, and we should definitely go into business something chickens, something eggs, because since both of us are kind of, I would say above basic chicken caregivers now, that we should kind of like cash in a little bit on this, not to be crass, but like, why wouldn't we want to teach people and help people and profit off of getting flocks set up for people all over the country even. But even though it's cold, I still think that you should probably hatch some eggs.
Well, it would be symbiotic, right? Because we're not just going to be a corporation that takes advantage of everyone and gives them crappy chickens. There's something, you know, so.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not like it wouldn't be mutually beneficial. Like, we would profit on the fact that we pay attention and recognize patterns, and so then are divinely guided to know what's going on. And then it would help other people to feed themselves during all of this.
Absolutely.
So I don't see a problem with it. I'm trying to just figure out how with an RV to be able to raise chickens, to like continue to do chickens, right? Because I love chickens. I just, because I obviously they can't live in the RV with me, but
mm-hmm.
I thought about saving up to get like a small trail, like a trailer thing that I could pull behind. And if I had a chicken wagon, they could free range wherever we go, kind of.
Mm.
If somebody gets upset, I would just have to real quick load them back up and pretend like they weren't free ranging with
yeah.
their tractor. But that might be something that I could look into. I've been trying to kind of figure out how to finagle that because I figured out how to grow food in the RV.
Oh, yeah?
The chickens are a little bit more of a conundrum.
The chickens, I think, honestly, like, at this point, like, brooding them, like, you know, basically, like, hatching them, figuring out what sex they are. Because let's be honest, a lot of places aren't going to be able to, for zoning purposes at this point, be able to sustain roosters, right? And so,
right.
You know, you give out roosters, good quality roosters. I would say just rehome roosters anywhere you can, anywhere where the zoning's good. But sell the chicks to people who want to start backyard flocks. Because honestly, like, this has been my one of my biggest goals since I started, you know, on this path of taking back resources, starting with food, is chickens, because chickens are pretty easy and chickens will sustain you in case of emergency. And, you know, anybody can really, besides very like urban apartment dwellers, would be able to keep chickens. Anybody with even a small backyard would be able to keep 4 to 6 chickens and be able to sustain their family on eggs at least. So that's,
absolutely.
You know, that's, you know, and then you can do like the, you know, you can sell chicks that are like, you know, that lay Easter egg colored baskets and things, you know, eggs. And, you know, there's all of these things that you can do to get people interested. And right now the price of eggs is so high that, you know, everybody should be having chickens right now. This, again, should be an empowering thing. I think I talked about this on my show, Seeds of Change, last week. That, you know, we should be able to be able to feed ourselves as communities. Everybody should be able, you know, to do these things. And starting with these very, like, seemingly, oppressive shortages that we've been having, like on eggs, like on baby formula, you know. And these things really should be empowering moments. You know, how did we survive before supermarkets? How did we survive before baby formula? You know, getting back to our roots, I really hope that chickens, just like, you know, the shortage on baby formula, where, you know, we can get back to our roots and kind of figure out how, you know, how we survived as long as we have without these very modern commodities. And, you know, so hopefully this egg shortage will be more of an empowering thing to humanity than an oppressive thing. That's my hope.
Absolutely. And I think it will be. I mean, we are supposed to be going back to the ways of our ancestors, right? Like, every convenience that they've provided us is a trap in a pretty package. And it wasn't always easy to see it that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trying to keep up with modern society and 9-to-5 jobs and everything else, but it actually was always a trap to kind of push us into a corner. But my favorite thing about COVID and all of this other stuff is that everything they do to push us back into a corner actually causes us to rise up and go the direction that we were always supposed to be going in the first place, and remember who we are and who our ancestors are, and then do that. And so I think it's all kind of a blessing in disguise. you know, sometimes you have to struggle before you can know what you're supposed to be doing and see where you've gone wrong, maybe, or been misled. And so ironically, while they're trying to make us suffer and make all these awful things happen, they're actually allowing us to remember who we are and do what we were supposed to be doing to begin with. And so I think that's pretty cool. Like, they're actually blessing us while their intention is to oppress us. And it's kind of like comical, but I really do believe that the great creator loves irony and a good story.
Absolutely. And they give themselves away. Like, the first video I want to play of Jimmy Dore is a Jimmy Dore clip where he talks about something that we've talked about for a while now. And it's the media and, you know, and quote unquote science, I call it trademark science, trying to blame heart problems on everything except for the thing that we know it is. And, you know, and of course we sarcastically post these headlines and for instance, sarcasm causes heart problems or strokes. I know you. I'm screwed. You're screwed. But you know,
I'm surprised I'm still alive.
I know, right? I check my pulse every morning when I wake up. And let's see. So Jimmy Dore, but Jimmy Dore actually covered it, right? Because, like, I really feel like these people follow me. I say to my husband all the time, I'm like, dude, I just reported on that. How come now Jimmy Dore is doing it and Tucker's doing it?
I mean, you're incredible. If I was a mainstream media kind of person or someone with a big following, I would totally report on what you talk about. So it makes sense.
You do have a pretty big following, don't you?
Well, I mean, like, if I did a bunch of radio shows or, like, talked to people and, you know, did, like, these really amazing things that you do to present information to people, and I was in, like, a mainstream media position or somebody like Jimmy Dore, I would totally follow you and just report on your stuff because I think you're incredible. So it's supposed to be a compliment, but I think it came out weird. I'm sorry.
No, I'm doing, like, 12 things at once, too. I'm sorry. But, yeah, I would hope so, you know. I've got some good information. I don't think they could ever admit it, you know, but let's see. Vaccine. So basically,
well, imitation is the highest form of flattery, so they already kind of have admitted it.
Did I say Jimmy Dore? So I'm trying to find where I put this. I just downloaded it. So shoot, hold on. Maybe I have to refresh. Hold on. But, I mean, basically this is all prompted by the fact that, you know, the federal government, the state of California, they're, you know, all ending their vaccine, you know, emergency orders as of, you know, May, I believe, is when Biden announced he was going to stop it. And California is at the end of February. But now, like, I think it really is important that we figure out what happened and make sure that this never happens again, you know?
Absolutely. I think that that is one of the most important lessons of all of this, right, is to not only remember who we are and take our power back, but also to make sure that we teach our children and our next seven generations in a way that this never can happen again, right? Because it only ever was able to happen because we gave our own power away through deception. But still, like, we are the ones that gave it away to other people. And so we need to remember not to do that next time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so here it is. Here's this Jimmy Dore talking about how vaccines are definitely not causing heart attacks or strokes, but everything else is. So here we go. 3, 2, 1.
So there's a biggest study ever on myocarditis and the vaccine. Vaccine study of 23 million show risk of heart problems from Moderna and Pfizer jab. And the subheadline, this is from Express, the subheadline is the risk of heart inflammation after receiving doses of the Moderna or Pfizer COVID vaccines has been laid bare in a huge new study of 23 million people. Myocarditis, that's the name given to inflammation of the heart muscles, or myocardium, the condition which typically results from viral infection, can serve to reduce the heart's ability to pump blood and result in the development of a rapid or irregular heart rhythm. Various reports from Canada, Israel, and the U.S.
I'm sorry, I played the wrong video. Although that was really important. I was like listening to this and I'm like, yeah, I don't remember listening to any of this when I downloaded it, but this is good information. But no, that's the wrong one. But here's the right one. Sorry about that. Jimmy Dore, 3, 2, 1.
So get this. This is the tweet out from the Children's Health Defense Twitter account. It says the media blames heart clot issues on sitting. Look, you want to see the stuff they blame it on? They blame it on sitting for 8 hours, traffic noise, excitement.
Hey, stop honking. You're clotting my blood in here.
Climate change. Mm. Time change.
Yeah.
Hot weather. Cold weather.
Mm.
Drinking tea, pollution, video games, and now eggs.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
I knew it.
And they give you all these headlines. It's very funny. All these wow, those are pretty funny.
I've been
headlines. Seeing
these for like a year straight. Like,
yeah,
bizarre. Like also exercising. Is that on there?
Ready, you ready? This lonely older women at greater risk of heart attack. Physical activity may increase heart attack, so you should stop working out.
Yeah,
that's according to
I
that.
I take a lot of boosters, so I think I'll be fine.
Heart attacks, the drink that could trigger a sudden cardiac arrest catastrophe. There's a drink that does it. Experts warn that shoveling snow can be deadly.
What a strange thing to warn about. What experts?
Did you mean that one, falling asleep?
This one? Falling asleep with the TV on could bring early death. That's right there.
Boy, it's so amazing that all these different things all have the same clot issue.
It's weird.
Everything causes clots.
Hey, does skipping your breakfast increase your risk of a heart attack?
No, my breakfast was a booster today. I have boosters for breakfast.
Climate change could hurt babies' hearts, says a study.
Because it's too hot to get them a booster.
Too hot. There it is. Shoveling snow can be a deadly way to discover underlying cardiovascular. Physical activity may increase. Rise.
Okay. I don't know what just happened. We were only like a minute and a half in, but anyway, so basically that's Jimmy Dore talking about everything that, you know, I think he forgets sarcasm though, which is unfortunate. Let's see.
Yeah. Sarcasm is the funniest one.
I know, and yes, and I did listen to the whole thing on that one, and it doesn't actually, he never talks about the sarcasm one. But there is one circulating right now that says too many breaths, and it's like the BBC reporting on it, too many breaths can cause heart problems, that I think they...
Like
they,
breathing too much?
Yeah, but I think they put it out there because it never actually happened, and now they can... say, oh, well, it's fake news, it's unreliable, because nobody ever said that, right? But there's all of these other headlines up into, you know, and including eggs, you know, that causes heart attacks. And, but you know what I mean? Like, they put out these, like, little propaganda-y ones, like, you know, badly photoshopped pictures that people share so that they can write a story on a fact check saying that this badly photoshopped, you know, pictures going around saying that, you know, Epstein was holding Trump's daughter, you know, things like that, things like, but now they're doing one with an article, a BBC article saying that too many breaths are causing heart problems. And so that they can censor it so that they can maybe like, I guess, cast a little bit of a doubt in people that everything else is real. Oh, well, you never really know what you see on the internet. A lot of that stuff is fake, right? Like this COINTELPRO book.
Right. Well, and in the same way that they told everyone that people who were telling the truth about the vaccine were causing the people who had the vaccine to have adverse reactions. Like that one was pretty wild. Yeah, we actually briefly discussed it on your show because it was so wild. And then I only remember because I got to like make a funny joke about how then that means that manifestation and healing yourself is also true, because if you believe something and then it creates the thing that you believe, then clearly our spiritual views are true.
Absolutely.
So it's like funny when we can twist it back onto them, right? Like that makes me happy.
Absolutely. So now, you know, the media is kind of reflecting on you know, the impact, basically, of COVID. Tucker Carlson last night had a pretty decent one that I'd like to play if you're up for it. Sorry about that first video fail.
Absolutely.
I'll put it in the chat so people can go back and watch it. But Jimmy Dore's the man for sure. But here's, you know, Tucker's basically take on this. So here we go. I think I just found it. There it is. Okay, 3, 2, 1.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. Have you ever noticed that there's not a single person in the entire overstaffed Biden administration whose job it is to announce good news? Not one. There's the now familiar Office of Attacking the Middle Class. They're usually quite busy. There's the Department of New and Counterproductive Wars. Those people never sleep. And of course, there's the all-powerful Directorate of Hysteria, which makes sure that every living American is terrified of something or other from breakfast till bed. But there is no good news office. That's something the Biden people never considered. So yesterday, the administration seemed a little awkward, maybe even sheepish, when it announced the best news of all, which is that the COVID era has finally passed. For 3 years, the U.S. has lived under a permanent government-designated COVID emergency. At this point, looking backward, no one can agree on what the point of it was. Certainly nobody got any healthier, that's for sure. In any case, it's ending, for good or bad. Technically, the emergency will continue until May. This will allow the Biden administration to shovel a few more cargo planes full of tax dollars to its donors in the so-called healthcare industry. But that's it. Those are the last gasps of the Rona scare. We're done. And that means, above all, that we can finally get to the second and much more satisfying part of the program, where we finally hold the people accountable who did what they just did to us. And first on that list would be Joe Biden. At this point, Biden has the functional IQ of office furniture, but his instinctive viciousness remains intact. So Biden, the second he got into office, wasted no time at all in blaming Americans for a virus that China created, and then in using the pandemic to pit neighbors against one another. It was the cruelest and most divisive thing any president has ever done to his own country. In case you've forgotten what it looked like, here you go.
I'm announcing that the Department of Labor is developing an emergency rule to require all employers with 100 or more employees that together employ over 80 million workers to ensure their workforces are fully vaccinated or show a negative test at least once a week. We're going to protect vaccinated workers from unvaccinated coworkers. We've been patient, but our patience is wearing thin. The last thing we need is the Neanderthal thinking that in the meantime, everything's fine. Take off your mask. Forget it. For unvaccinated, we are looking at a winter of severe illness and death for unvaccinated, for themselves, their families, and the hospital they'll soon overwhelm.
Our patience is wearing thin, Americans. If you want to take an untested experimental mRNA shot from a company that has bought immunity from Congress against future lawsuits, you are a selfish Neanderthal. Worse, you're a killer. You're literally killing your own neighbors. The only good news is you will soon die yourself because you deserve it. That's what Joe Biden said. The president said that to his own people, and it was, of course, a lie. Leaving aside its potentially terrifying side effects, the shot did not work as advertised. Sorry, it just didn't. It did not prevent people from dying, did not even prevent them from transmitting or getting COVID themselves, and that's why vaccinated people still wear masks. Everyone knows this, but Joe Biden has never admitted any of it, nor has the federal government rehired the thousands of good people, really the best people, the Navy SEALs, the nurses, the EMTs, the firemen, the airline pilots, the people who were fired from their jobs for making what turned out to be a pretty solid medical decision. And by the way, no one's ever explained why it was immoral somehow to treat COVID before patients wound up on respirators. Why? What was so bad about ivermectin and monoclonal antibody therapy? We still don't know. The administration still won't tell us where the virus came from, though obviously they know the answer. But now is the time to find out. We need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to get the bottom of what we just lived through, and let's hope we get one very soon. But in the meantime, this being Washington, the end of COVID, the end of the emergency, poses a much more immediate political problem for the people in charge. The Democratic Party can't govern the country without emergencies. If the public is ever allowed to calm down long enough to think clearly, uncomfortable questions might emerge. Wait a second! If my kid can't get into a good college or work at a big company because he's white, how is this systemic racism thing real? And if it is real, why can't I just change my race like all those people on TV are always changing their sex just by wishing it so? What's the answer? Can you imagine if people started asking questions like that? That would be bad. It would be a disaster. So clearly the Democratic Party needs a new emergency, at least until we start sending ground troops to Ukraine and the population becomes suitably hysterical again. So because they need an emergency, they found one. And the new emergency turns out to be the old emergency, which is white racism. Now, unfortunately for the Democratic Party, white racism is one commodity, like cedar boards, that's getting harder to find. Very few unarmed black men are killed by white cops these days. Where's George Floyd when you need him? So instead, in a pinch, they've settled for an unarmed black man killed by black cops, which they've informed us, nevertheless, despite all appearances, is still the product of white racism. And Barack Obama enthusiastically agrees. This is Barack Obama's lane. He was elected president twice on this kind of stuff. So he immediately jumped into the middle of the Memphis tragedy to remind us that white middle-class Republicans did this. Blood is on their hands. Selma, Dr. King, Rodney King, Trayvon Martin. They're all the fruit of white supremacy. It's true. And as Obama explained on Twitter, you can learn a lot more about how it's true on his website. Okay. So we decided to go there. We went to the Obama Foundation website today. And there we found an entire section on how we have to continue to defund the police. Yes, people are still saying it. Quote, cities like Los Angeles, Baltimore, and Philadelphia have reduced their budgets for their police departments, the Obama Foundation explained without laughing. These cuts made funding more available for other elements of public safety, like affordable housing. Right, because affordable housing is public safety, unless that affordable housing is in Chicago or Baltimore, in which case you're likely to be killed. But whatever. The point is, take three steps back, Barack Obama, the former president, is weighing in directly on America's latest fake hate crime. And you have to wonder why. He's not doing it for himself. Obama is retired at this point. He's living on Martha's Vineyard with all the other rich white people. He's doing it for his wife, who's never had a real job and apparently is feeling kind of restless approaching 60. And that's why you may have noticed that 6 years after leaving Washington, Michelle Obama is back in the news. She's got a new book and a media tour, and even a federally funded hiking trail named for herself in Atlanta. Why has she emerged in this way? Well, there might be a reason. In fact, if you didn't know any better, if you were visiting this country from a foreign land trying to figure out what's going on in the U.S., you might mistake what Michelle Obama is doing right now for the beginnings of a presidential campaign. So first, you have a manufactured white racism panic. That's a clue. But the clincher is menopause. Unlike every other woman over 50 in all human history, Michelle Obama, we're sad to tell you, has menopause. It's not clear where she caught it. Maybe there was an outbreak in Edgartown. But it's bad. At one point, Michelle Obama gained up to 6 pounds. You don't know how much she suffered. Let's put it this way. Baton death march survivors, she laughs at you. You can't fathom her pain. Watch her talk about it on TV.
I am still physically active, and my goal now, instead of having Michelle Obama arms, I just want to keep moving. Just keep moving. If I can walk, move, I don't have to run, I don't have to beat everyone. So I've had to change the way I see myself in my health space. I never used to weigh myself. I'm not trying to stick to numbers, but when you're in menopause, you have this slow creep.
You have this slow creep. And no, she's not talking about Joe Biden here, who is technically one of the slowest creeps in America. She's talking about her own thighs. Now, why is Michelle Obama telling you about her menopausal thighs on a TV show? Possibly because she's a crazed narcissist who thinks her own thighs are interesting to you. And that's, of course, true. But there may be other reasons. Consider that today's Washington Post expressed deep dissatisfaction with Joe Biden's current heir, Kamala Harris. Now, Harris is a woman who cannot even consistently pronounce her own first name. And she might not be, as the Post suggests, up for the job of leading this country. And we're quoting. Some Democrats are worried about Harris's political prospects, the paper says. They're worried she may not have the, quote, political skills to win a national race. Whoa, wait a second, pale colonizer. Kamala Harris doesn't have skills? Isn't that racist? Well, as the Post reports, yes, it is. Quote, some party members fear that Americans are simply not willing to elect a woman of color as president, especially given the racism and sexism they see emerging in recent years, because there's more now. So here's the problem for the Democratic Party. The current vice president is totally incompetent and universally loathed by everyone, including her staff and possibly her husband, who literally kissed her with a mask on. We're not judging, but you can see it for yourself. So you don't want her, but you can't just ditch her for a white dude. Sorry, that's not equity. So where do you go from here? Ooh, good question. And it turns out it's a question that Michelle Obama seems to have been thinking about recently. Here she is this fall, considering the matter of whether her elderly old servant, sorry, her dear, dear friend, Joe Biden, should grace this country with yet another term as president. Watch.
But it's a tough job, and I think that he's doing the best he can under some tough circumstances.
Do you hope that President Biden will run again in 2024?
You know, I will have to see. It's, you know, the reason I don't speak on that is because I know what it feels like to be on the other side of it. And I think that that's a personal decision. I don't want to be one of the millions of people weighing in on what he should do.
He's doing, pause here, the best he can. As for whether he runs again, Michelle Obama is going to have to, much longer pause here, accompanied by a wearied sigh, she's going to have to, quote, have to see about Joe Biden. Have to see. The question is, will the rest of us have to see a whole lot more of Michelle Obama in the next 2 years? Subscribe to the Fox News YouTube channel to catch our nightly opens, stories that are changing the world and changing your life. From Tucker Carlson Tonight.
Okay, that was a lot. I know. That's like, what is that, like four topics in a row. But I'm sorry, I'm doing like four things at the same time again. But Zach is here too, so I'm going to try to let him in and see if his audio is working a little better. Let's see.
Check, check, check. Hey, how's it going?
Good. Actually, yeah, it's better than it was last week or 2 weeks ago. So hi, thanks for calling in. This is a last minute thing. The proof negative show is what we're doing right now because Proof is in the hospital dealing with some health issues, but he should be on the mend very soon and hopefully he'll resume his schedule next week. But I'm honored that, you know, everybody can be here for this and that Zach can join us and we've got Lily here also. Looks like we've got a Skype caller too. So, if you're listening and you can push one, if you'd like to be a part of the show, we'd love to talk to you, caller. But right now, I'm happy that we've got Zach and Lily with us. So, Zach, did you happen to listen to the last video or audio? Excuse me. Or did you just catch the tail end?
I caught some of it. That Michelle Obama was talking about menopause.
But I think the main takeaway of that is that she's probably going to run.
Oh, yes, run is put. Yeah, well, maybe they're going to try and get her to run and pull Biden out. Is that a change of batter? Is that what they're doing?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because she was asked about, whether she would support Joe Biden, and she was wishy-washy on it. So, I think she might throw her hat in the ring.
Well, it's interesting. She's a background as a corporate attorney, if I'm not mistaken, from Chicago.
Makes sense.
It's not like the Uniparty isn't in that mode anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I know I'm trying to get you that link. I'm not sure if it's going to go through. It seems like voice is a little bit clearer on on the computer, but I just resent it.
Okay.
Yeah. But Lily, what did you think?
I don't know. It was interesting. I mean, I don't have much use for Michelle Obama or politics anymore in general. So, you know, like, I really don't. I think it was funny that he, and smart that he brought up the narcissism of thinking that people on the television, like, want to hear you talk about your size and your menopause. It's kind of weird. And, yeah, the way that she did that long kind of strange pause when she was asked about Joe Biden would make sense if she was going to run. And also because, like, what can you say? I mean, these people lie all the time, but even they have a hard time at this point defending that man. So,
yeah, for sure. But then there's, you know, also, so Zach, at the beginning of it, we were talking about, or Tucker was talking about basically the end of this COVID lockdown emergency order. And, you know, and basically, like, the lessons that were, you know, hold on. I think Zach is on the computer. Hold on.
Unmuted.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
So much better.
Great. In the flesh.
Okay. So at the beginning of the show and at the beginning of the segment of Tucker's, he was basically talking about the end of this emergency order and what it means for us and the lessons that we've learned and the lessons that we haven't, and basically how to take this, you know, this painful time in history and use it for the betterment of humanity. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that most of the country has gotten a lesson in the Constitution, and a lot of people have become constitutionalists all of a sudden and are reading the Bill of Rights, that they matter.
Yes.
In a way that most of us dismissed, those of us coming from the left-hand side of an ideological spectrum kind of have maybe reoriented and view pragmatic politics as in this case, as a politics of necessity, that when certain rights are there because of if you don't have them, then, you know, then nothing else matters. And there aren't elections if you can spy on your political opponents. And, you know, for example, the Fourth Amendment and Second Amendment rights do matter at a certain point. People watching Australia go through lockdown, and also what happened in China and Shanghai, I was just talking about, where there's mass murder of people to weld them into buildings so they couldn't get out and they died. And that has, on a global scale, changed the way China is inside, the way the people are reacting to the government says do this, the government says do that, and let's suspend our rights. Here, it's played out differently, thank goodness, and that maybe half the country didn't buy it as much and in phases are becoming what I would say kind of more red-blooded Americans and reading the Constitution and saying, where's my free speech? And free speech actually matters. There is no assembly if you don't have free speech. And we're seeing that, being, you know, the January 6th is a good example. I've had friends that I used to lead into government buildings doing, it wasn't exactly civil disobedience. It was more of a protest. You know, we would leave if the police showed up and start clapping, the police need a raise, the police need a raise, as we got back on the buses quickly. And they would never attack us because you'd be really a jerk if you attacked a crowd as police when they were chanting for a raise for you. So that was our little tactic.
Exactly.
But people that I know that I did that with are now saying January 6th is just an insurrection. I'm, oh, what are you talking about, Phil? Like, we went into buildings together exactly like that, and this building was unlocked, and this is the Capitol building. This, if any building is owned by the people, it's that one. So
exactly,
I think a lot
yeah.
of people shock treatment are being shocked awake.
Gosh, I hope so. You know, and you know, I guess a common theme that that I've had on my show is that especially the people that bought into it the most. The Jimmy Dore calls them the lockdown left. They're really starting to possibly question whether what they did was right or not. And, you know, I say to those people that still hold on to the narrative on the left that it's just, I guess, cherish those people because they may not be around for too much longer if they just keep submitting themselves as experiment, you know, as, you know, the subject of an experiment. So, you know, to those people, I just say spend as much time with them as you can, as they will allow, because it's possible that those people aren't going to be with us for very much longer. I even had a friend this, you know, just relatively recently, who was talking about their father who came out from Pennsylvania and had a stroke just days after arriving here. And that was back before Thanksgiving. And, you know, it's easy to say, you know, hashtag papers, please, on the internet, but it's really hard to talk to your friends and family who have had loved ones, in my opinion, possibly injured by this vaccine and this and COVID in general. You know, it's so hard to talk to those people and say, well, you know, were they vaccinated? How recently were they vaccinated? But we can ask all day long on the internet. You know, those, and I think that the left are the people that were most impacted by it. So, you know, that's what I say. Just love them while if they still allow you to you know, be a part of their life, because it's possible they might not be here for too much longer, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And also the bigger point is also we can't lose our humanity in this process. That's the whole point, you know, so we can't fight for our rights and collective humanity, but at the same time applauding the petty point or see, told you so. But you're right, it is difficult to engage people, especially because there's been it's not just a direct signal of harm. There's been an exacerbation of things that, for example, have come back. People have, you know, had something that went into remission and cancer is coming back at an alarming rate. And there's an enormous amount of that. In addition to kind of the denial of treatment and good treatment across the board for all conditions and healthcare in the last 3 years, take that as it is, as, you know, the parallel to that is that we have schools that didn't learn in 3 years and have this big vacancy where they're not passing exit exams at all for the whole class, you know, and you could apply that sort of image to what's happened in some groups of people in healthcare that they had zero. And the medical industry is basically, depending on your doctor or region, or is sticking their head underneath the into the sand, you know, hiding under the table, and didn't answer their phones, didn't answer the call, as Peter McCullough said. You know, one famous doctor, the most famous cardiologist in the United States, or most published, said that he considered this to be a Super Bowl, and I think Peter Corey also kind of echoed that they wanted to rise to the challenge. But a lot of doctors have been picked off, and so the whole medical establishment needs to be reworked from the public. And a lot of people have kind of creeping symptoms that are showing up, and sometimes they're showing up in terms of infections, SIBO, right? That's not something that immediately gut malfunction and infection is not going to be something you immediately say, well, that was because of the vaccine. But if you diminish your immune system and downregulate the rest of your body and it's dealing with a toxin or a toxic spike, then glutathione and liver enzymes are going somewhere else and maybe not doing what they need to do. So then the body moves out of balance and things that were kind of managed are now becoming more acute. All at the same time, you know? And yeah. So I don't think we're out of this for a couple of years. I mean, this is horrible.
Right.
But
I even think there should be some kind of a study on single car crashes, right? Like if you just, you know, how many people have, or articles have you seen locally or nationally where people just, you know, just lose control of their vehicles You know, I think, you know, and I know that that's something that's always been there, but I think there's been an uptick in those. You know, people that just, you know, die in their car. I think there was that, who was that Will and Grace actor, Leslie something, that, say, you know, same thing, just crashed into to a building on his way to the doctor, right? And now he, we know that he died of some kind of heart issue, but he, his car just crashed into, you know, a wall and he died that way. How many more of those are out there? How, you know, I even hesitate to look into the you know, into cancer, into the deaths of cancer. But a lot of them, but when you, when you look at the, this was an undetected, it just happened, you know, this mother just died of brain cancer and just didn't even know it. You know, it's like there's
so
much.
Yeah, it's aggressive too. Yeah, it's not just the widespread, it's aggressive, it's relapsing. And then, you know, there's things that would have been managed otherwise by the body or by the healthcare system.
Yeah, that are just, you know, and so honestly, I don't think that we're going to for many, many years now, if ever, understand the full scope of what this COVID crisis did to our, to humanity, did to our population. But, you know, if you go just one step down that road, it's like, is it possible that that was the point all along, is to depopulate, you know, pick off the useless eaters, quote unquote, you know, that, and so, you know, there's so many questions that need to be answered. And I don't know if we're going to be able to ever get them answered, especially in states like California. You talk about, you know, it's region by region how people can, you know, doctors can speak up. But in California, they passed laws saying that you will have your medical license revoked if you, you know, go against the mainstream scientific narrative. That's just, you know.
They just put it into writing. I mean,
it's incredible.
Okay, big shot doctor. Who do you work for? You work for us.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And they can do that. And a lot of these doctors will just have to take it because guess what? They've got families that they have to take care of. Mm-hmm. You know, they've got medical, you know, medical school debt, right? They've got so many of these, you know, worldly problems that they have to deal with that they will just stick their heads in the sand and look, you know, and not address it. And it's really, really sad.
Yeah. Well, my father was an oral surgeon and, you know, a lot of their income stream goes through insurance and referrals from other doctors and systems with the hospitals. You know, you mentioned about accountability, and I know there's a lot of discussion and lawyers, you know, kind of what kind of legal global trial could you have? If you look back at what was happening for – And again, I think the Nuremberg trials are a little overrated, but it, as a model, one thing that ironically or maybe, you know, just disgustingly, is that you can't implement these sorts of policies on a mass scale without bureaucracy. And, for example, Albert Eichmann, I believe his name was, one of the primary he was very good as a logistics person implementing the Holocaust in Germany and concentration camps, moving of people, all this stuff required a system that they put together. And so one way that typically whistleblowers have been known for, but average citizens, anybody, us collectively and individually and as groups can get hands on documents, which are the actual levers of how people like this, or if you want government or deep state, implement power. There is a paper trail and they have to have one. Some of it is incredibly sickening, you know, that they document their trials and discussions about modifying and weaponizing documents. And there's also a funding trail that's necessary, you know, because they want to, they're so perverted, they don't know right from wrong, and that would be, could be possibly used against them until it becomes obvious, and then they try to destroy it, which in and of itself is evidence of the crime. But getting documentation is how power is used. So if you want to get your hands on it from the point of a citizen and you don't have insider access or attorneys, you go through the documentation that implements things on you and you work backwards. So a healthcare insurance card has your social security number, has the certain thing, has payments, and then there's a classification code. And for example, Dr. Brian Artis has, you know, demonstrated that there were classification and payment codes to hospitals to use certain protocols coming from the CDC. And doctors were then beaten, you know, browbeaten to do that specific treatment, you know, and some are toxic in particular. So there's your, you know, if you follow that as a model, you want to understand how did this happen and you have outrage, try to trace back the mechanism by which they implement the bureaucracy.
Yeah.
It's not easy, you know, but that is where it is. That's how power is used and implemented.
Okay. So I have, kind of I don't want to say inside information on this kind of stuff, but I did watch all of the press conferences, you know, all of the big city press conferences and definitely all of the national press conferences. And I actually have a dental background. I ran dental offices for 10 years. So my ears perked up when you talked about oral surgeon. they talk about classifications and Dr. Mm-hmm. Burks very early on talked about how they're classifying COVID deaths, just the mm-hmm. deaths, right? The protocols that come afterwards are different. But I have the clip here. I'm going to play it. It's only a minute and 20 seconds. But this is Dr. Burks talking about this exact thing that you were talking about and how the bureaucracy gets in intertwined. If you guys don't mm-hmm. mind, I'll play this.
Standard of care is the framing. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Are you good with me playing a quick video mm-hmm. or audio, Lily?
Absolutely. And I'm really enjoying this conversation, by the way, just listening to you two.
Well, okay. Awesome. Let's play this. And then I actually would love to play another one right afterwards, which is the public health director of the state of Illinois talking about kind of the same thing. So, all right, I'll play this Dr. Burks one first. All right, here we go. 3, 2, 1.
Misreported by coronavirus because of either testing or standards for how they're characterized?
So I think in this country, we've taken a very liberal approach to mortality. And I think the reporting here has been pretty straightforward over the last 5 to 6 weeks. Prior to that, when there wasn't testing in January and February, that's a very different situation and unknown. There are other countries that if you had a pre-existing condition, and let's say the virus caused you to go to the ICU and then have a heart or kidney problem, some countries are recording that as a heart issue or a kidney issue and not a COVID-19 death. Right now, we're still recording it, and the great thing about having forms that come in and a form that has the ability to mark it as COVID-19 infection, the intent is right now that those, if someone dies with COVID-19, we are counting that as a COVID-19 death.
Okay, so she says, and it's funny because I have this like image kind of burned in my brain of Dr. Burks, you know, standing on the podium and talking about the forms and having, you know, the ability to check a box basically, and her checking the box in air. To somebody who's filled out a lot of insurance forms, that's right there. The beginning and the end of, not really the end, but the beginning of the big problems that we've had with COVID classifications and how mm-hmm. the bureaucracy gets involved and says, you know what, it doesn't matter if you have COVID or if you've had COVID, that's it. We're going to mark it as a COVID case and or a COVID death, even if it's been some, you know, very completely different cause of death. Mm-hmm. And so Dr. Ezeki from the state of Illinois, another press conference that I followed every day that they had them, kind of further clarifies what Dr. Burks is saying. This is only about less than a minute, so I'd like to play this just to kind of, pin the two points together, that the whole time they were classifying, you know, things very differently than reality. And I think that they continue. So I'm going to play this quick audio. 3, 2, 1.
I just want to be clear in terms of the definition of people dying of COVID. So the case definition is very simplistic. It means at the time of death, it was a COVID positive diagnosis. So that means that if you were in hospice and had already been given, you know, a few weeks to live, and then you also were found to have COVID, that would be counted as a COVID death. It means that if technically, if even if you died of a clear alternate cause, but you had COVID at the same time, it's still listed as a COVID death. So everyone who's listed as a COVID death doesn't mean that that was the cause of the death, but they had COVID at the time of death. I hope that's helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that's
helpful. Well, I'd just like to say this is straight out of the AIDS playbook in the 80s of classification to drive fear, completely unscientific for them to, you know, if someone has comorbid fact. The other category that had to be reapplied to the data is that comorbid factors, which are things that would kill you otherwise. So if you have renal dysfunction, right? Getting a flu could be a serious imbalancing factor that could lead you to die. Would the flu have killed you otherwise? Statistically, probably not. But if you have that, or heart disease, diabetes, severe obesity, which was a big category being checked, all of those things are more likely. So the cause of death, is it the flu? Probably, you know, that's not really fair. So if you backed out all the comorbid factors, and I remember the first data rework that was leaking out was coming out of Italy. And you saw a similar kind of rework here in the United States, I think at the end of last year, not 22, but at the end of 21, that only about 10%, you know, maybe 12,000 people died, then they didn't have other comorbid factors, right? This is before the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you know, there's 12,000 is laughable. It's below the what you would expect from the flu. It's far less lethal. And then the message would be people who have to worry about this anyway would be worried about this just like they would be a flu. So bang, your pandemic goes away. And then you start looking at excess deaths. Oops, we didn't really have many excess deaths.
Right.
During COVID. So they had a real problem with this data. And so the restructuring it, but this is also what they did during the 80s. But back then we didn't have comorbid factors with over the half of the United States with obesity and potentially as high as 80% having some kind of comorbid factor. I'm trying to wrap your brain around that. Like 80% mm-hmm. of us have something like that. It's pretty significant, but that doesn't mean that COVID and that those flu symptoms killed you, you know, and a lot of these deaths were also in the hospital and we've gone into that, right?
Right. Because they tested everybody.
Mm-hmm. Which is also ridiculous to
exactly.
make. Yeah. So if you have someone who's not, who doesn't have symptoms, number one, you don't quarantine them. That is ridiculous to do that to an entire population. It changes the dynamic. It prolongs kind of the achievement of natural immunity and herd immunity. And then also to test everybody, first of all, you're creating anxiety on everybody every time you give them a test. Just go do their blood pressure before they go into a doctor's office and just walking into the room and sitting there before the doctor talks, and you'll see people's anxiety shoot up.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so that's ridiculous. And all the fraud with – you just got to call it fraud with the way those tests were performed. All the data is garbage. You cannot actually say what they're – what they tested and what they produced, which is made, by the way, for media consumption, right? That data is created in the form to be consumed by media. So then if you wanted to track how that ruling happens, you look at how, you know, how those numbers get made and how they get fed to the media in what form, and then what policy is driven by that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Which is all of our policies, basically. And that was one of the most catastrophic things that happened during COVID is that, you know, the gross overreach of government powers and how far and how insidious it reached into every element of our society, whether it, you know, it was the grocery store, the doctor's office, you know, and everywhere in between. It was, you know, it, going to the beach. I know that doesn't affect most people, but, you know, like, I can't, what do you mean I can't go to the beach? Like,
right.
I mean, it sounds like a small thing, but, you know, this is how people stay healthy, a lot of people. And
negative ions from the salt water, that'd be great. That's always healing. If you ever stand by a waterfall and you feel better, I mean.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, my dog park is a beach. You know what I mean? Like, it's people pay a lot of money to live here, and it's a lot of it has to do with the health benefits. I feel like Lily's been a little bit quiet today, so I want to give her a little. I know she's enjoying the conversation, but Lily, do you want to give your input on this?
Sure, and yeah, I really have been enjoying listening to both of you just talk about it, because I feel like you both just have a really eloquent way of getting your point across. But I, you know, kind of echo your same feelings, right? Like, it was a completely tyrannical overreach of government power, and it was, while it was really disappointing to watch people kind of just go along, I kept wondering, you know, like, when are enough of us going to say that we're not doing this, that it'll make more of an impact, you know? And then there were some, like Joanne, that were fighting it in a little bit different of a way and, you know, getting lawsuits and things together against people fraudulently enforcing masking and stuff. And so that was really cool to watch. But I think that it was necessary for all of that to happen, as unfortunate as it is, because, you know, we were talking earlier about sometimes we don't see where we've gone wrong or what we need to do better until we struggle and suffer a little bit through it. And so I feel like that was very eye-opening, even for people that, you know, kind of seem to support the government and follow the government and believe what it says. Even people like my stepdad, who very much thinks the government is necessary and would rather die than watch the government collapse, his own words, are starting to notice, you know, that something is very wrong and has been very wrong, and these people really don't actually care about his well-being. And so I think that all of that is really necessary, right, to be able to move in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, like, I'm kind of weird, but I try to find the few things in any situation that I can be grateful for and focus on those ones, because otherwise I'm just like a ball of anger about the whole thing.
But there's two sides that have that are typically institutions on the left: education, higher education, including primary education in high school, and the labor component in there. And also labor in terms of the workforce, not organized labor in the schools. These institutions were on the cutting edge of implementing these policies. And how eye-opening, if you're going to lose your job if you don't get this medical procedure, right? You're not going to be educated. You can't have a career unless, and you can't go to college, you know, whatever that means. The best part of your life is not going to happen then. You know, these institutions, I think people are going to circle back and say, yeah, we're going to redo everything here from top to bottom.
Absolutely, as they should. And, you know, one of the things that initially really caught my attention and actually kind of helped my own life, because I've always worked like two or three jobs, since like high school, is that when they told everyone that they weren't essential – and nothing was essential. School was not essential. Higher education was not essential. Any jobs, for the most part, unless you were like working at grocery stores and feeding people or doing things that they couldn't do remotely, were not considered essential. And, you know, and it felt like they started telling the truth, right? Like, this is not what life is. None of these things are essential, and none of them matter. And so while I feel really badly that people, you know, then couldn't get food when they needed to sometimes and lost their businesses and all of these awful things happened, I think it also told us and reminded us of a really important truth, that none of that was ever essential. And somehow we bought into it being essential and important and being everything and wasted you know, entire lifetimes working at jobs that we hated, that were soul-sucking, going to schools to get degrees that we didn't end up using, all of these things, right? And for what purpose? Because then all of those things could be taken away. And so really the only essential things were the things that they couldn't take from us, like our family members, well, the ones that didn't decide they hated us because we told them the truth, but you know, like things like that. And it kind of, I think, allowed a lot of people to take a minute to pause and breathe and really focus on what was important to them and on how to sustain themselves. And just like with the chicken situation now, you know, now people are realizing if you can't afford eggs at the store, but you can afford a couple of chickens to live in your backyard, then you can do that. And then, of course, they threw in, and I'm not sure, it's not a controlled opposition, I don't think, although they're spinning it off to be in a way with this chicken feed situation and chickens not laying eggs anymore. And then, of course, some of the right is spinning that into, well, when they start laying eggs again, you can't eat them because now they're terrible. And I don't think that's the case. But it has reminded people, you know, like you don't need to buy all of this chicken feed when you can do like your mom, Danielle, and ferment it and also feed them chicken scraps and also let them free range, because the chickens that are doing those things have never stopped producing eggs.
Correct.
It's just the ones that are being fed the commercial corporate feed. And that opens up another situation to look into, right, about not only what are we feeding our chickens and why are they putting things in now that would stop egg production, but what does that mean for the food that we eat and consume that we did not produce ourselves, or
excellent,
somebody that we know or love, you know, or a farmer at least, like, did not produce it, but some corporation did.
Yes.
And further, like, everybody that has animals, as far as my knowledge goes anyway, really loves their animals. And so what are we feeding our animals when we buy commercial dog and cat food? And we could all make those things on our own. Like, I have spent this last couple of weeks really learning, before I move into the RV, how to make my own soaps and lotions and shampoo and mayonnaise and just all kinds of things that normally I would buy and not think about too much,
mm-hmm.
you know, like to just make them myself. And I think that that's something that would be actually a really easy step that everybody could do, right? Just like once a week, tell yourself, I'm going to learn how to cook something by myself that I would normally buy, like mayonnaise. It's a great one to start with because it's literally just a couple, like three or four ingredients, depending on how many spices you use.
Mm-hmm.
It's just avocado oil and one egg. And you just blend it and add whatever. I add mustard and a few spices, and you just add whatever you want to taste. And then that's it. Right. And you've spent like maybe $2 compared to the $6 or $7 you would have spent at the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes less than 10 minutes. Right. And
there's
so that's like my favorite part about all of this is we just move. It forces us to move into taking care of ourselves and taking responsibility for ourselves rather than the convenience of allowing someone else to do it for us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's so
I make
well
my
said.
Own, I make my own floor cleaner now.
What do you use?
Awesome.
It's so simple. It's clove, which everyone has and nobody uses enough of because it's a little bit powerful, right? Sometimes I sprinkle
mm-hmm.
clove in my coffee in wintertime, but clove and bay leaf. So I'll sacrifice a bay leaf or two and then boil it. And then you take that and just pour it into white vinegar. And away, and I strain it, so you're not putting clove on, you know, that doesn't look good. But bugs don't like it, and it's not toxic, and it's anti-mold and fungus, too. And so you strain the clove and bay leaf after you cook it about 20 minutes or so, and put
mm-hmm.
that in vinegar, and away you go.
Oh, my God.
Super.
I'm writing that down as we speak. That's amazing. Another thing is like dog and cat food. Like what can we figure out what dogs and cats are really supposed to eat? Because if we think that it's just this dried up, you know, kibble, it's not true. We took my dog off kibble. I want to say two years ago. and it's like she hasn't aged a day. And it's not, you know, there's no way that what a dog is really supposed to eat is in that dehydrated garbage. Yeah,
they don't
no
eat
way.
Grains. I've never seen a dog hold a sickle to cut the wheat. Have you? I mean, maybe dogs can do that.
Absolutely not.
You know,
maybe every once in a while they'll eat the stomach of an animal that eats grain.
Yeah.
And they'll get it that way, but that's it.
But that's digested too, you know, and there's going to be grass in there, bugs maybe even, you know. I think rice is probably a little more benign, but I still don't know about that. Dogs, anyway, I've seen eat go vegetarian by their owners. I've seen them eat tofu, broccoli, be pretty happy with that. I don't know that much about them, but it should be pretty easy to make.
We do more of the...
I read recently that cat and dog food was the equivalent of feeding yourself only McDonald's for the rest of your life, and that's basically the equivalent of the anti-nutrition level that we're giving our animals. And so it also makes me wonder, as well with the vaccines, of course, but I don't remember it being normal for dogs and cats to have allergies and to be allergic to grass or be allergic to go outside, right, and have to have all these medications. And I feel like that is a vaccine injury, but I also wonder if some of it isn't caused by the food that is basically just the same kind of processed poison that we eat when we eat at some place like McDonald's, and that's what we're feeding them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Their lifespan must be way shorter, you know? Like, my dog eats... organs and salmon and sometimes sweet potato, sometimes, but like it's eggs. It's very much, you know, my dog just unapologetically will go into the chicken coop and eat an egg. And I know that that's what she wants because that's what she needs in her diet. That's what, you know, that's what these dogs are supposed to be fed. And, you know, I mean, I guess I could, I would hear the vegan argument, but it would be hard for me to understand how an animal like a dog would be nourished on a
explicitly.
Without intestines and
without the organ meat. Yeah, I do think that's the organ meat is probably the biggest thing that's missing out of when you take the grains away. The organ meat is the biggest plus, I think, out of all of those. You know, and by the way, they would be eating if they were eating animals. Those animals would have more omega-3 in them. And they will eat grass sometimes, but I think really that's more of a digestive imbalance thing. If they've got allergies, then that's their immune system coding food as poison, right?
Right.
So maybe, I've seen dogs improve when they were sick by taking more omega-3, which would be in the – it would be animals that ate wheatgrass or ate grass, the old grass, the back when there was iodine and other minerals in our soil in the United States. So those animals would have healthier fats in them. I know there's a push to feed chickens flaxseed and other seeds, and that's been marketed quite heavily. I don't know if they should just eat flax seeds because chickens, for example, eat worms, they eat bugs, you know. Who knows what they else eat, you know?
I give my dog, Lady Tiva, we do chia seeds, and it works really well. Because if we don't do chia seeds, then she does get, with this natural diet, she does tend to get, anal gland issues. But just a tiny, tiny amount of chia seeds in her meal, we cook for her two times a day, is good for her. You know, that if she's so healthy, she's probably 9 now, and she still goes on 2-mile-a-day walks. You know, she's so healthy. She's, no skin problems, no health problems whatsoever. I can't really argue with what we're doing because it seems like it's working.
Mm-hmm.
Do you cook the food, Danielle, or do you feed raw? Because I have seen mixed reviews, between the two, between whether – you should just grind up the bones with the meat and feed it raw with egg, or other people saying that they cook it. And I feel like for storage purposes, at least in a smaller space, like an RV, it'd be easier if I could cook it and then just store it.
Mm-hmm. We do both. We do a hybrid. So we do probably like 50% raw. When we do, say, ground beef, we do 50% raw and then 50% cooked. Now, when it comes to bones, which they also need, we do raw because you can't, you know, if I want to give her a chicken wing, which they can totally eat raw, you can't eat a chicken wing cooked because it splinters and is bad for the bone, right? Or bad for the stomach. It could perforate the stomach.
Right. I didn't know if you were supposed to use like a mortar and pestle and grind up chicken bones and put them in. No, like, I'm just trying to figure out how to do that.
Yeah. As long as it's raw, they can eat it. And they say if you want to be like really particular about it, they say no weight bearing bones, so no legs, but wings are okay. And we do that. We just get her wings, but that's just because we're trying to experiment with, you know, this dog had a rough life before we rescued her. She was abused, and, you know, we've had her for a long time now, and it's just been amazing to see her, you know, come out of this abused state into this beautiful alpha. I want her around for as long as we possibly can. So we're just, you know, as far as, you know, I guess you could say experimenting and doing the best of the best that we can for now. And that, you know, to us is, you know, we give some raw and some cooked. It's supposed to be a little bit warm, and that's part of the cooked, pull to the cooked part of it, because they kill their prey and they eat it while it's still warm. You know, we've gone all the way down the rabbit hole on this. And so I would say 50-50 as far as raw versus cooked.
You could always
add like different like vitamins and or powders or whatever that you add in, or does she just get all of her nutrients from the food?
Other than the chia seeds,
because I know like cats have to have taurine or they'll die, and I don't know if dogs are similar to that.
Yeah, they're not. They're okay. So there's calcium requirements and we do sometimes we use a calcium powder, but we really do try to give her as close to nature as possible. But I really don't think that there would be any kind of like huge, deficiency in using some powdered forms of nutrition. You know, I think, and especially when you're talking about a risk to benefit ratio of kibble, I think that powder's probably fine, you know, but I just really think that any advice that we can give people to get away from that really processed food for cats and for humans is probably for a benefit, you know. So, you know, I guess long story short, if you have
absolutely
to add in powder, then it's probably better than kibble.
I just wanted to check in about that because I have Pippin is only like 9.5 weeks old. And so, you know, I want to make sure that he is getting all of the like calcium and other nutrients that he needs is the reason I asked.
Yeah, that's I'll do a little research that's like puppy centric because I've never done this on a puppy. Like I said, she was an adult. She was probably like 6. When we started, well, maybe a little older than 6, when we started doing just the raw. So let me give you some puppy-specific stuff. I'll send it to you.
I love you. I'm sorry to, like, ask a million questions during the show, by the way.
No, this is a call-in, I think, question and answer show. That's fine.
I used to run a health food store, and I would have some people ask about this for pets, for supplements. And Vibrant Health is a company that I have a good deal of respect for. And they had a UT Health and also Joint Health. And so there are some certain herbs like blueberries, cranberries, dandelion, golden seal, parsley that were very helpful. And there was also a joint one. And that was like, you know, kind of what you would kind of expect Joint Health to be. So there's some people out there that, are, you know, and I know there's a whole discussion, a lot of community that's interested in this.
Thank you, Zach. It's nice to meet you, by the way. You're awesome.
Nice to meet you.
You guys should be friends on Facebook. I'm going to connect you.
You know, one thought about the cooked food is the more trauma an animal has had, the more dysbiosis, you know, dysfunction in their gut to humans. And there is a really direct line between human, you know, between emotional trauma, and you might think of psychic trauma and the way our gut functions, which is kind of the cradle of our hormones and sets the tone for our other hormonal glands. So kind of our whole life rhythm starts there, if you want to think of it that way. And our genetic history in some ways because of the probiotics, you know. So in other words, the bacteria that live in our guts are sensitive to our emotional traumas. And there's more of them than there are of us. That's also true of the animal, of our pets. And so cooked food sometimes is more digested sometimes. It's all kind of about an enzymat, how enzymes play in the gut and elsewhere, and tearing that food apart. So cooked food can be helpful in the way that sometimes people with injured gut problems need soup that's been cooked a little bit. Hot soup mm-hmm. is better than raw food, for example, for certain intestinal issues.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an expert in that.
That
I don't
makes
want to
a lot
sound
of
like
sense.
I am, but I'm just drawing how you would think about it if we're similar. Cats, I think, is a whole different world. I'm talking about dogs.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, cats are, and they, most people that do natural cat food really push for the raw, which becomes a little bit more difficult just because you have to, like, completely grind up the bones that the cats need. Mm-hmm. So it's a little more difficult than dogs, but it's doable. So I'm going to figure it out. I think if I just, like, bake the bones on a low temperature for a while so they're extra, I guess, and then use the mortar and pestle, maybe that's how I can grind them.
Well,
because the butcher used to be willing to grind them up for you, but they're not allowed to do that anymore.
Well, you're starting to get, that's like half the process to make bone broth. And I was actually going to ask about this. Danielle, have you ever used bone broth? I mean, because you're basically, if you cook it and bake it and then you soak it in apple cider vinegar to kind of draw out some of these, both the minerals and collagen and proline and other amino acids that you're making collagen with, right? The mm-hmm. gel, like if you have your turkey and, you know, you notice there's a gel around your meat, that's collagen has gotten out into the juice from cooking the bones from eating, you know, and this is something your ancestors did, eating head to tail or tail to head, whatever you want to think about it, throw in the organ meats. But, you know, what you're describing is phase one of cooking usually a beef bone or a lamb bone would be even better. Something mm-hmm. that's very clean, hopefully, but you can also buy collagen powder. You can buy bone broth in the grocery stores now. That's organic, pretty widely available, or you can make it.
I have an Instant Pot that I do. Anytime I have a carcass of any kind, pretty much, I put it in the Instant Pot with water and whatever, like onion leaves or whatever I have this kind of left ends of the celery, you know, I throw all that in there, and everybody should get an Instant Pot. Some people might be intimidated, but that thing is essential for survival. That's why
I got an R2D2.
You got one? Yeah. That thing is
I got a Vortex air fryer and an R2D2. I'm a little worried about no stick surfaces. Haven't quite gotten there into these products yet, but, so has your dogs like collagen or do they like the bone broth?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, and every once in a while, like whatever we can't, you know, get with the food that we give her, we'll go to, a specialty store and get, there's one actually right up the road. That is just a mom and pop specialty dog store. It's called the Pet Pantry. It's not a sponsor, but if they want a sponsor, I'd be happy. But it's just a mom and pop store right down the road for me. And they just, anything that you need as a supplement for a dog or cat, nutrition, they have, and they just have, they're like a library of knowledge on the mm-hmm. things that, okay, well, what are you feeding them? You know, and they'll write down everything that you're feeding them. And then, you know, okay, well, you might be missing this. Cause at first, you know, we had no idea what we were doing. And it's like, well, okay, well, what about, organs? You're not giving your dog organs. Well, they need organs. Oh shit. Mm. You know? But you know, there's going to be probably, virtually around every major city, and actually, the farther away from the city that you get, the better the knowledge get of survival, but there's always going to be a small community around you that has this knowledge. And honestly, I think that's how we're going to survive this next phase, because I'm not really having much faith in the systems that be right now. They're not doing a very good job. So, you know, how much longer is it going to be until we're all going to need to be able to feed our dogs and ourselves without fast food, without grocery stores, you know? Mm-hmm. And hopefully over the last few years, since at least 2018, people have been listening to me and help, you know, and people like Lily that, you know, have been trying to prepare people and teach people how to can and teach people how to make bread and, you know, survive baby formula shortages and egg shortages, mm-hmm. right? Like, hopefully we're well connected enough that we can get these questions answered as we go.
For sure. Ooh, Danielle, maybe we should work on like a little survival book together with like the easiest bread recipe and the easiest like beginner's canning thing and all of your chicken and gardening knowledge. And we could just make like a little, you know, kind of like free ring binder, like little survival pamphlet thing. And
mm-hmm. Especially medicine. Medicine is so easy to make, and, you know, and I probably would get in trouble defining medicine. But before we had big hospitals, the traditions of herbalism worked. Homeopathy worked, which is incredible to me. You know, those things were very functional and were satisfactory to a great degree. I mean, if you're not talking about surgery, if you're talking about routine care, you're coming down with a cold or you're coming down with things, there's the nutrient way, but then there's also the things that are actually growing in your garden and you can grow, and with some either oil or hot water or alcohol, you can make what is sold in a health food store as a tincture. Mm-hmm. There's nothing really magical about
Absolutely.
It. You just put them together. You know who you should have Danielle on is Christine Shaheen Wood, who for years has been a practitioner of natural cosmetics. Okay. Has her own companies, written a book. She teaches courses on it and also has raised several daughters that are also one of them is very much into flower essences. So you want to talk about some of the most high-powered neurochemicals to change your mood are flower essences, all right? And you get people like, that's crazy. Rose, yes,
rose, yep.
Lavender, but even beyond that, and if you really know how to mix these, I used to have people come into my, you know, into my store, and they would come in on dates and poof each other with the flower essences, you know,
so
here, try
awesome.
This honey, poof, 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 you know, so they'd make this cloud and they were, it works. There wasn't any depression going on after that, you know?
Absolutely. That's amazing.
You should write that part of the book, Zach, like herbalism, because it really is phenomenal. Like my dog, this puppy that we got recently came here and was sick and was like sneezing, and pretty soon all my other animals were sneezing, and I started giving them colloidal silver, and 2 days later, nobody was sneezing anymore. They were fine. I just put it in their water, and they didn't even notice. They just drank it, and then my older dog, Olive, cut her nail open, and I've just been using Arnica, and she's not limping. She's running around like normal. So there's a million like really helpful things. When I had really bad pneumonia and I have asthma, Molin saved my life with a little bit of eucalyptus and a couple other things. Like, it's really phenomenal what plants can do. And, you know, Dr. Sebi told us that all of our real medicine was our food.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You know, in upstate New York and Syracuse, where we used to call Snowacues, and I sometimes I question why I moved from Charleston, South Carolina, or Columbia, South Carolina, where it's subtropical, kind of like San Diego, except humid, and then went 1,000 miles north and lived in a place that has an average 120 inches of snow every year on average, and it snows in May on Mother's Day, and it's, you know, what a mess. But the indigenous folks that live there, actually in sovereign country, if you will, and a highway goes through it, but it's actually another country still, the Onondagans, which was part of the Confederacy that the Dutch called Iroquois, but their name is Haudenosaunee. It was just Six Nations, and they made a confederation. They, quote, buried the hatchet. That's where that comes from. And on the lake, they have a peacemaker story of Hiawatha coming in a stone canoe on Onondaga Lake at Syracuse. You know, it wasn't called Syracuse. That's a Greek name. But that's the place where the capital was. So these guys are still there, okay? And it's a clan mother system. I don't want to go all the way into that. But these people influenced the founding of this country in a really big way, and Frederick Engels of Marxism at the same time, and feminism. So these folks are still have their own country. And what they would say, the moral of the story is, that they, in the spring, they would say this is free medicine, you know, and in the springtime, not quite now, but maybe late February, you get some small flowers and small leeks. And they would start eating leeks because, you know, kind of in the fall, they would traditionally eat salmon, and with the Three Sisters, corn, which would grow a stalk, beans growing up the stalk, and squash on the ground around the corn. Well, those things will last into the wintertime. You get some vitamin C and A in the squash and vitamin C in the corn, and, you know, hopefully your salmon you've prepared. But by the wintertime, end of the winter, you're starting to, you know, and they would detoxify eating wild leeks for a few weeks to a month. And so February into March, these leeks are coming up everywhere. Kind of like after that, you get dandelion, and you can eat those too, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just a little bit of oil and mushrooms and maybe something, some garlic, you know, but hopefully they're not too powerfully bitter or toxic, you know, from the pesticides. But that's what they would do, you know, and this is a month where food, here it is. It's coming up for you. I've seen wild asparagus, wild celery. Have you ever seen this stuff in the wild? You're like, wow, it looks just like it, except it's huge.
Yeah.
It looks like the grocery store, except it's totally different.
Yeah, it's amazing. We need to guerrilla garden more wild varieties of spinaches and lettuces and leeks and all kinds of things because, you know, we can just guerrilla garden them and then literally have food forests in every city, every state, everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yet that there's a lot of study in that. Well, as organizing, doing some community organizing, we did a charrette with a designer at the Environmental College at SUNY, which is right there in Syracuse. I believe Professor Carter was an expert. There are a couple of people that have studied this in the United States about urban food and urban gardening. You know, so community centers, particularly in low-income parts of the United States, tend to have food deserts. And for one reason or another, businesses, grocery stores tend to move further and further away from those residents. So they have to take a bus and then haul it back and forth, right? Because there's no way to walk to it. Or the only thing that they can walk to are garbage, you know, corner stores, which are really crime stores, you know, where there's cocaine and heroin and stuff being sold out of there and all kinds of stuff, prostitution, guns, arrests constantly. So those, the place where they could get food, it's not getting there. But they do have community centers, and those do have a good deal of land. And there's also a lot of vacant lots, unfortunately, because houses get torn down. When they get vacant, then they wind up getting torn down. So you have an extra lot. So cities that encourage those extra lot policies, the take over the lot next to you for a dollar, you can own that extra lot land in the city, you know, if you garden on it.
Where was this?
Well, that was in Syracuse, you know, but I'm saying else, you know, all over the place. And there are academics that study what you're saying, you know, and when I was working with a community as an organizer, I was hired as an organizer basically for most of the more African-American grandmothers that would hold the city accountable. They wanted resources. They wanted a seat at the table in a sense on specific issues from crime to banking to trash in their neighborhood. And the use of city planning doesn't, unless you've got an advocate for it. Like I remember the city planner started doing a charrette design. And that's what you've got to do before you ever put money behind something. You've got to have a plan and a design, an architectural design. Well, that costs money. So who at the city downtown is going to do that? Are they going to design the Riverwalk? Again, it goes back to documents. You know, okay. Are they going to design the Riverwalk, which the business community loves, or are they going to design the urban forest edible plants, you know, the apple trees and other things that grow in the hood next to the Southwest Community Center? Well,
right.
You know, he started doing a little of that because we were talking to him, and he got yanked back. So we had to go around him and go get academics and then put pressure on the city and say, no, 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 you're going to do this. Otherwise, we're going to start showing up unannounced in your offices with the media. You know, you
right.
come to us or we come to you. And but then you have to have constant pressure. Otherwise, the money doesn't flow. Right. So it's kind of at least two steps. You got to have a designer and then you also have the political will to get the money there. But easily done.
Yeah.
Whether or not
I would argue,
are walkable, you know.
I would argue that they, because they have allowed so much crime and in fact encouraged it in many ways, that we don't even necessarily need to ask for permission anymore. Not that we ever did because we're sovereign, but even so, instead of asking, that we just do it, right? Like fill some salt shakers with seeds and go sprinkle them all over the place. Make, you know, like the clay seed bowls and throw those everywhere. I mean, I highly doubt anyone would be arrested for doing that. And if so, then you just drop the seeds. And what proof is there that you had them in the first place? I
what
mean,
seeds, Your Honor? Exactly. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, all right. So this is, indulge me here because, there is kind of a middle ground. Okay. And it happened in the city of Los Angeles in all places because, you know, honestly, like we live in paradise in California. A lot of people would disagree, but when it comes to the climate, when it comes to the weather, and when it comes to the things that we can grow here, there's a reason that so much of the country's food comes from California. LA and San Diego have very similar climates, and we technically don't have a frost, which is why I've got two tomato garden forests growing in my backyard, because we don't have
cheating.
A frost. And it is cheating, but I don't care. Mother Nature, it's like the Mother Nature lottery. We are but basically it's like if we can't do it, then Chicago and Boston and New York, they've got no chance. We can do this year round. So I really have like used my platform to really spread the message of, especially in my general surroundings, my little corner of the world. Let's show them how it's done. Let's show them that even in these urban food deserts, that we can actually feed our community. And so there's a man named Ron Finley. He goes as by the gorilla gardener or the gangster gardener, who accomplished these very urban gardening goals. And basically, this is his story, him explaining how he in South Central LA was able to achieve these goals with, you know, basically just by one person planting, you know, food on the side of the road. Mm-hmm. So will you guys indulge me in a quick video on this?
Yeah.
Awesome.
I think I've
okay,
heard of this.
Go.
Absolutely.
I think I've
Yay.
Seen this before.
Yeah. Okay.
I
well,
love
then,
him. So
I've seen it about 20 times and I will watch it 20 more, I'm sure. So here we go. 3, 2, 1.
I live in South Central. This is South Central. Liquor stores, fast food, vacant lots. So the city planners, they get together and they figure they're going to change the name South Central to make it represent something else. So they change it to South Los Angeles. Like this is going to fix what's really going wrong in the city. This is South Los Angeles. Liquor stores, fast food, vacant lots. Just like 26.5 million other Americans, I live in a food desert. South Central Los Angeles, home of the drive-through and the drive-by. Funny thing is, the drive-throughs are killing more people than the drive-by. People are dying from curable diseases in South Central Los Angeles. For instance, the obesity rate in my neighborhood is like 5 times higher than, say, Beverly Hills, which is like probably 8-10 miles away. I got tired of seeing this happening. And I wonder, how would you feel if you had no access to healthy food? If every time you walk out your door, you see the ill effects that the present food system have on your neighborhood. I see wheelchairs bought and sold like used cars. I see dialysis centers popping up like Starbucks. And I figured, this has to stop. So I figured that the problem is the solution. Food is the problem, and food is the solution. Plus, I got tired of driving 45 minutes round trip to get an apple that wasn't impregnated with pesticide.
There you go.
So what I did, I planted a food forest in front of my house. It's on a strip of land that we call a parkway. It's like 150 feet by like 10 feet. The thing is, it's owned by the city, but you have to maintain it. So I'm like, cool. I do whatever the hell I want. Since it's my responsibility and I got to maintain it, this is how I decided to maintain it. So me and my group, L.A. Green Grounds, we got together and we started planting my food forest, fruit trees, you know, the whole nine, for vegetables. What we do, we're a pay-it-forward kind of group where it's composed of, like, gardeners from all walks of life from all over the city, and it's completely volunteer, and everything we do is free. And the garden, it was beautiful. And then somebody complained. The city came down on me. and basically gave me a citation saying that I had to remove my garden, which this citation would turn into a warrant. And I'm like, come on, really? A warrant for planting food on a piece of land that you could care less about? And I was like, cool, bring it. Because this time it wasn't coming up. So L.A. Times got hold of it. Steve Lopez did a story on it and talked to the councilman. And one of the Green Grounds members, they put up a petition on change.org. And with 900 signatures, we were a success. We had a victory on our hands. My councilman even called and said how they endorse and love what we're doing. I mean, come on, why wouldn't they? L.A. leads the United States in vacant lots that the city actually owns. They own 26 square miles of vacant lots. That's 20 Central Parks. That's enough space to plant 700 million, 725 million tomato plants. Why in the hell would they not okay this? Growing one plant will give you 1,000, 10,000 seeds. Okay. When $1 worth of green beans will give you like $75 worth of produce. It's my gospel. I'm telling people, grow your own food. Growing your own food is like printing your own money. Thank you. I have a legacy in South Central. I grew up there. I raised my sons there. And I refuse to be a part of this manufactured reality that was manufactured for me by some other people, and I'm manufacturing my own reality. See, I'm an artist. Gardening is my graffiti. I grow my art. Just like a graffiti artist, where they beautify walls, me, I beautify lawns, parkways. I use the garden, the soil, like it's a piece of cloth. And the plants and the trees, that's my embellishment for that cloth. You'd be surprised what the soil could do if you let it be your canvas. You just couldn't imagine how amazing a sunflower is and how it affects people. So what happened? I have witnessed my garden become a tool for the education, a tool for the transformation of my neighborhood. To change the community, you have to change the composition of the soil. We are the soil. You'd be surprised how kids are affected by this. Gardening is the most therapeutic and defiant act you can do. especially in the inner city. Plus, you get strawberries. I remember this time, there was this mother and a daughter came. It was like 10:30 at night, and they were in my yard. And I came out, and they looked so ashamed. You know, so I'm like, man, it made me feel bad that they were there. And I told them, you don't have to do this like this. This is on the street for a reason. It made me feel ashamed to see people that was this close to me that was hungry. And this only reinforced why I do this. And people ask me, Finn, aren't you afraid people are going to steal your food? And I'm like, hell no, I ain't afraid they're going to steal it. That's why it's on the street. That's the whole idea. I want them to take it, but in the same time, I want them to take back their health. There's another time when I put a garden in this homeless shelter in downtown Los Angeles. The guys, they helped me unload the truck. It was cool. They just shared the stories about how this affected them and how they used to plant with their mother and their grandmother. And it was just cool to see how this changed them, if it was only for that one moment. So Green Grounds has gone on to plant maybe like 20 gardens. We've had like 50 people come to our dig-ins and participate, and it's all volunteers. If kids grow kale, kids eat kale. If they grow tomatoes, they eat tomatoes. But when none of this is presented to them, if they're not shown how food affects the mind and the body, they blindly eat whatever the hell you put in front of them. I see young people, and they want to work, but they're in this thing where they're caught up. I see kids of color, and they just on this track that's designed for them that leads them to nowhere. So with gardening, I see an opportunity where we can train these kids to take over their communities, to have a sustainable life. And when we do this, who knows? We might produce the next George Washington Carver. But if we don't change the composition of the soil, we will never do this. Now this is one of my plans. This is what I want to do. I want to plant a whole block of gardens. It was just where people can share in the food in the same block. I want to take shipping containers and turn them into healthy cafes. And now, don't get me wrong. I'm not talking about no free shit, because free is not sustainable. The funny thing about sustainability, you have to sustain it. What I'm talking about is putting people to work and getting kids off the street and letting them know the joy, the pride, and the honor in growing your own food, opening farmers markets. So what I want to do here, we got to make this sexy. So I want us all to become ecolutionary, renegades, gangsters, gangster gardeners. We got to flip the script on what a gangster is. If you ain't a gardener, you ain't gangster. Get gangster with your shovel, okay? And let that be your weapon of choice. So basically, if you want to meet with me, if you want to meet, don't call me. If you want to sit around in cushy chairs and have meetings where you talk about doing some shit, if you want to meet with me, come to the garden with your shovel so we can plant some shit. Peace. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I mean, that's basically what I'm about. I really would love to bring him some blackberry bushes. Technically, I looked it up during the video. I have the same growing zone as him. So I don't really see a reason that we can't spread this to everywhere in Southern California. And if we're talking about being the change, I think being the change on a local level is probably more impactful at this moment than anything. If you can get a salt shaker, or a red pepper shaker, I think is the best, but, you know, I digress. And you know, sprinkle seeds all over your community. Why not? You know, there's no reason to, especially within, you know, this, gosh, Southern California is a pretty big commodity. It's a pretty big, you know, we are what the biggest, maybe the sixth biggest economy in the world is Southern California.
Yeah.
And if we can come together and actually just show the world that we got this one resource, I don't know. I think it could be a really powerful change.
Well, you know, there are, have you ever seen artists put together a place, like a mini library? We've been doing this in Savannah a little bit. Like there's it's enclosed, but you could open it up and it's outside and people can put books in there and whatnot. And it's a mini library, but you could also do that with as a seed bank in the community and locally distribute it. Right. And, you know, I don't think people are really going to try and resell seeds, but if they do, that's okay too. You know, but you could create seed banks within certain communities. And that in itself puts it in people's hands. I thought that it's interesting that the space and the land, by the way, there is a toxics issue with land that you have to go through, that you have to test the land and the dirt and the soil. So there's that part of bureaucracy to negotiate, but still, vacants are, you know, I don't know if it's really people understand why there are these gaps in the community. Like the vacants are there when people can't make their payments or whatnot, and they leave or they get evicted. But really, it's because they can't pay and they lose their mortgage. And what happens is it's vacant and then people break into them, steal everything out of them. And this is tends to be, you can say that these are people who are criminals. These are gangs, little bit of both. But when you wonder what a gang is, are usually from the studies of that were done in Rochester and in San Francisco, those were very early kids that could be great leaders and help with peer mediation and conflict resolution, and would therefore decimate the gangs when they did these peer mediation programs. So the gangs kind of are our children in our community, and he's hinting to this, that he wanted the future of the children to be the future. But to part of that, you have to interrupt the cycle of violence, and that goes through the schools. The schools are a major player in this. So conflict resolution and mediation for peer mediation works in schools, and it decimates gangs. So that pressure on the housing is important to change the atmosphere, because there's a safety issue too. And then, you know, putting them to use into gardens. And part of that can start also at the school. They can teach gardening at the school. I know that people are going to make fun of that, community gardens, but there is an enormous change when students have a contact with dirt. Children who have grown up without contact with dirt do not develop neurologically because of the bacteria in their gut. So I'm not saying go barefoot all the time, but you're going to touch dirt. I don't really wear gloves. I probably should. But, you know, all of this is part of the same stream. So you have a violent stream that results in housing destruction and gaps in these spaces. So, reusing these spaces, if you also combine them with policies that redirect and also introduce these skill sets at school through gardens at school and comp and mediation programs, peer mediate. And I'm talking about second and fourth graders, and the fourth graders are usually the children that you have to send to the principal's office. I don't know if people realize that, but they are the ones looking for esteem and looking to be a leader, and they can mediate as good as second graders. I've seen it done. And they're just as good as any divorce mediator, probably better. We're sitting down at these little tables with second graders who maybe had a playground fight, okay? And they want a role. And what gangs do is that when they're 7, 8, 9, 10, is they start giving them responsibility and they show them respect, and they all of a sudden have a male leader that actually cares for them at some level. I wouldn't say that's parenting, but they're putting them in harm's way. But the point is that this is replacing the family in impoverished communities. So, okay, my rant's over, but I want you know to connect those. Some of these also
totally
develop business skills. The farmers market, Syracuse had something like that, you know, where they grow farms. They call it the Farm Stand Project. But the problem is scaling those things. So if a community wanted to do it, got together and wanted to do it, and then you put the money behind it and you raise the money, you can do it. You can scale up businesses so that there's serious farmers markets. There's serious food cooperatives, right?
Yeah.
But you got to be able to scale it and make it and long haul it, because this is a dedication. He's dedicated. This person is very dedicated.
Right. And really, at the end of the day, what he's mainly talking about is city easement gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as somebody who's been in the same climate, and I'm not talking about how, you know, I live in a very privileged neighborhood. I grew up in a privileged neighborhood in Southern California. But I can tell you that in the same, you know, the same amount of city easements happen in LA than in San Diego. And we've got the same growing climate. So what I'm saying is that with zero effort, actually it would take effort to rid, you know, to plant a couple tomato seeds and get rid of them. If you just let them, you know, establish on a sidewalk, you're going to have tomatoes here in South Central or in Southern California in general, in San Diego, and anywhere from, you know, the border to Central California, you're going to be able to grow tomatoes and strawberries. That's why he brought up these kind of obscure things. You know, if you live in a place with, you know, I call it weather. I know that's kind of, you know, ditzy or whatever, because, you know, that's what we call it here. If it rains, it's weather. But I know weather is, you know, a mix up of everything. But we're like, oh, my gosh, we're having weather, right? But so in places that have weather, like actual snow, I guess a frost, right? You know, this is kind of weird, but to my region here, there's no reason that we can't take over the sides of the road. I understand like toxic soil, but you know, you can test and then do raised beds. Like there's many things that we can do.
And also they have, universities have cooperative extensions that will do that testing. So again, if you support it and you know, a little bit of fundraising for it, you can make sure there's no cost for it. And the cost is usually minimal, $25, $50 usually for soil samples.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, and we can work other, you know, realms. We can do raised beds. We can make sure that the soil that's toxic isn't anywhere near good soil. And, you know, and it's just, you know, going around the last few years, just, you know, walking the streets of San Diego, like there's a legit pumpkin patch just growing on the side of the road, three blocks away, you know, that nobody planted.
Someone threw a pumpkin overboard and all the seeds.
Years ago. And it just keeps coming back. Every year there's a gigantic sidewalk pumpkin patch just right in the middle of our neighborhood, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's not like our streets are terrible. It's not like they're any better than Central LA, right? So what I'm saying is that we have the growing climate that we can feed everyone. We can teach everyone, every child, how to grow food, what growing food looks like. We can feed children with that food that, you know, in schools if we wanted to. There's so much potential, but it just takes a shred of knowledge and, you know, energy. And, you know, I just think that this is such an easy, low, you know, pardon the pun, but low-hanging fruit here. And Southern California can feed every single person. We can have, you know, chicken coops, you know, block by block. You know what I mean? You don't even need roosters. You don't even need to worry about, like, the noise violations. We can give everybody eggs. We can give everybody food with such minimal effort that, I don't know. I just think it's a huge, you know, goal that I've been working towards. And it seems like it's kind of working.
You know, in urban environments, one of the concerns still in the United States is lead that from paint that has chipped off into the soil or other contaminants. If you have metals, for example, if you were to plant something, you could plant mint, which grows like, you can't stop it, and roses, which also have value, a commercial value, right? If you're growing roses, roses are more high maintenance, but both plants, and I would maybe at the end of the story, these are not for consumption, maybe to look at the roses, but they pull significant metals out of the soil. In Weedsport, those are used. I don't know if you've ever heard of a living machine. There was one built in Maryland, and small communities, and this is basically tanks in, if you imagine, kind of a greenhouse, the size of maybe an oversized garage, and different tanks are cleaning the water, literally the sewage, and we're talking fecal coliform, feces, all the bacteria, cryptosporidium spores, all the stuff that's in poop in your sewage, including, I don't know how they're doing with pharmaceuticals, but a couple tanks, the first tank, they'll have plants, including mint and roses. Now, you have to take them, and then you have to take them in their toxic waste, right? But now you've taken it out of the water, or you plant it on the soil. The next are slugs, and then the next one might be fish. And each kind of process in nature filters out and cleans bacteria. If you see running streams where fish live or where fish are more popular, it tends to be where there's oxygen, and that water has been cleaned by plants, slugs, algae, all the life cycle, right? And at the other end, and you can walk through this and it doesn't smell. You can use this as you got a mini aquarium here, and you can walk, kids, you can walk through it. And at the other end is not necessarily, no one's going to say that you should be drinking it, but you could put that on your garden. And, you know, there's a way to get out of this. Up in Weedsport, they snow blow it under when it's freezing, and it'll go into the marsh, and then you can either harvest it and take it out, and the marsh will digest it. You know, they didn't even use a single chemical. All they did was blast the sewage up into the air. It freezes, and the bacteria is instantly killed because it's separated from water. Bacteria can't live when you separate it from water. Bang, you've just sized all your waste. And the solid particulate goes into the waste, the wetlands, and then they can harvest that, take it out, process it, and the wetlands will regenerate. Not a single chemical in either of these processes for clean water. But, you know, you're talking about kind of, you could build a greenhouse next to that. If not that you need one in San Diego where you have weather.
Yeah, right. Well, but
do you want some bugs? We have extra bugs here in Savannah. We could give them to you. Pollen? Do you want pollen? Cheap?
We're probably good. But Lily, do you think you can use any of these mechanisms in your RV travels? Maybe you can freeze some some water and in a pop-up greenhouse. I don't know. Like, San Diego is kind of perfect. So, well, except for the politics and the fact that we play the is this human shit or dog shit game every day when we walk our dog. You know, like, it's California's awful in a lot of ways, but we can grow some food.
The RV is actually interesting because the dashboard is huge. And so on part of it, it was taken apart and all the hoses were sticking out and it was ridiculously loud. So I built a desk for road school for the girls. But on the rest of it, there's so much space that I can do like starter, in like a small kind of greenhouse thing, I can do starter seeds. And then I hung macrame everywhere because I have cats, you know, they unfortunately like to eat all of my plants while I'm sleeping. And so I have to hang them. But with the macrame, I can hang plants everywhere. And so I'm doing a mixture of plants and soil from the starter and also hydroponics, because with the crack key method, you don't have to have a system with like a water pump. So it's much easier than aquaponics for an RV kind of situation, but you can just grow tons of plants inside glass mason jars, and then you just have to be, or like plastic bottles, whatever, but you just have to be careful to put like some construction paper or something around the outside so that algae doesn't grow. And so I'm pretty excited about that because I should be able to have a decent garden, you know, like a mix of herbs and vegetables at least. I'm not sure about fruits right now, but definitely herbs and vegetables.
Also mushrooms. Yeah. You could grow mushrooms, too, fairly easily.
Oh, yes, I'm excited to try some more mushrooms.
You were also talking about that warm space for plants. You can use that for yeast starters, too.
Yes. Yes, and then that's my goal, is to, like, get better at doing all of those things in the small amount of space. So then when we travel through places and we come across people that maybe need some help with food, I could just give them a starter and some little seedlings or whatever, you know, and then still be of service to other people.
Right. That's
as
why
we're
you
kind
need
of
to
like traveling along.
Too.
Yes.
Have you ever made any sauerkraut? Or is that too volatile to be moving around with?
I have. So I'm kind of, I've never done the RV thing before, so I just renovated it, and then I have those mechanical things to fix. It's a 1988, so she's amazing, but she just needed a little bit of love. And so anyway, I'm really new to this RV situation, but, I mean, I made all of my fire cider and tinctures and stuff, and I feel like it does bounce a little bit, but I feel like if I just have things you know, like maybe in my cupboard space where I've got all of the mason jars of herbs and stuff, if I put some of my clothes in there in between, then it would help me with storage, but also would kind of keep things from bouncing around too much.
Mm.
So then I would be able to do things like sauerkraut and all kinds of fun stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you were talking about giving things to people to start. That's a fantastic one. I saw someone start a kombucha, which looked like an absolute alien fungus when it got so big. You know, so once those things get going, they're pretty self-sustaining.
I've got a mean sourdough recipe.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, will you send it to me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would like
Thank
that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Now, they say that the only real sourdough is the yeast over in San Francisco, though.
I'm in California. It's close enough.
In California? Maybe, do you know the genetic history? Did you test it and make it sure it came down, came south?
No, I made it myself. And it's delicious. And you know what? And I am spoiled. Like, honestly, like, I do know the difference between, you know, light, you know, sourdough and extra sourdough. And, you know, the like, I did research how to do it. And it really has to do with rye flour versus, you know, just regular flour. But I'll send you guys my little cheat sheet. And it's not even my cheat sheet. I can't really take credit for it. I just like well researched and, you know, did the actual experiment. I did grow the yeast. So it's delicious and it's the extra sour. So I didn't go that far. Maybe if somebody wants to send me an heirloom sourdough starter? That would be amazing. But in a pinch, this is what I got. And it's really interesting because it's like when you go through all of this to grow your own starter, it's like basically following the recipes from, you know, the Dark Ages, right? These people, you know, when they talk about going to the grindstone, right, back to the grindstone, it really has to do with making your own bread. But most of that is your starter. And it's growing, you know, flour and water, making a living thing. And, you know, and this is another commodity that people are like, how are we going to have bread without grocery stores? But it's so easy, you know, to do it yourself that, you know, I hope to give that back to people. I hope that more people actually can see that making these kinds of bread, you know, these necessities, supplements to your diet, that they're really easy to make and that it's an empowering kind of thing versus a, oh my God, you know, how am I going to survive without, you know, the grocery store, you know, it's not that hard to do.
I tend to look at the most expensive things first, you know, the things that I look at, you know, I order in bulk and I say, man, is that worth $7 a bag for these crackers? You know, I bought these things called Flackers. They're flaxseed crackers. I flipped it over, looked at it. What's in this? This cannot be that hard. And it's flax seeds, apple cider vinegar, salt. And I'm like, okay, flax seeds become gelatinous, and you put it in the apple cider vinegar and or water, and then they dry out. I'm going to try and spinalize my – so I made my own flackers. They're $7 a bag if you buy them in the grocery store. You can buy a whole pound of flax seeds. I put some chia in there, and you, I'm going to put them in a dehydrator. But I did it in the oven, and it came out, you know, so you can make your own crackers. Like, after that, I'm never buying crackers again. Forget that.
Right. Yep.
Forget it.
No, it's totally true. And it, there's these little things that, as a society, we've grown accustomed to getting them a certain way and not understanding how to make your own cleaning products or not or your own, you know, soaps and candles and, you know, these very basic things, antibiotics even. And some, I mean, I'm not saying penicillin or anything like that, but there are plants that you can grow to heal yourself. And there's so many of these things that, you know, I think Lily's right. We should grow, we should have a manual on how to do this or Facebook, I'm sorry, a YouTube channel, you know, just for these things, how to make these things and, you know, and how our ancestors did it and did just fine with it. Probably, you know, longer lifespans than we're looking at right now.
It's a good time to start doing it as well, like not only because we're preparing because, you know, they're collapsing the economy and it's prophecy and all of that, but also just because, I mean, when you go to the store and you try to buy something, the reason that I made homemade mayonnaise, for example, was because I looked at the bottle of what I would typically have bought, and it said, even though it says it's all natural, it said contains bioengineered food ingredients. And almost everything at the store that's not organic, which isn't affordable for everyone, you know, I live, it's funny because when we were talking about like gangs and inner cities and stuff, that's exactly where I live. I live in North Omaha, right in between two rival gangs. We have shootings in my neighborhood a couple times a day, a lot of days, and at least once a day, every day. And we have all of the vacant lots and all of the things going on here that we were talking about. And so here, you have to travel quite a distance to be able to get organic stuff. And, you know, and it's not an option for everyone. And so anyway, when you go to the store, it's almost all bioengineered food ingredients now. Mm-hmm. And so for the same reason that I don't want to take an mRNA vaccine, I don't want to eat bioengineered food. And so it's kind of a good time to start making our own, especially for people who, for whatever reason, didn't want to take the vaccine. It's coming in the form of all kinds of other things. And now we've got Bill Gates talking about, and he talked about it a few years ago, but it's becoming a little more mainstream now, that they are working on some lab-grown spinach and lettuce varieties that will contain the mRNA vaccine, and you don't have to go get an injection now to have it. And so with things like that, I just think the more that we can provide for ourselves, that, you know, we should just do it. And also the issue of sovereignty, like the first rule, everyone wants their freedom and sovereignty, which I agree with, but the first rule of that is taking responsibility for yourself, including your own food and your own medicine. And not, you know, if you rely on a service for other people to do it for you, that's fine, but then we don't have any choice in how those things are provided, how they're grown, what they're grown with, what they contain, any of those things.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're making it your own and you can get virgin oils, really of any kind, you've changed the entire complexion. You know, these processed seed oils, which are lubricants, they're industrial lubricants. Okay. really, in around the 1970s is when we saw them start to get used, and margarine had kind of a run before that got dumped. And finally, they took over. The last kind of ethical doctors kind of conceded, I think, around the 90s, where the pharma really took over and owned the show. But getting these seed oils out of mayonnaise, out of food, is enormous. And your body, you know, has very bad problems breaking them down. They're toxic. So anything like that isn't food. But yet they're also standing in for very healthy omega-3, omega-6, sometimes omega-9 oils that are very important, you know. Even if you're using olive oil, even that's been kind of, you know, you have to look at purity for that. So they've even corrupted and blended some of this garbage and sold it as olive oil or other oils. And now I've been seeing statistics on avocado oil, which is a fantastic fat, you know. And so changing that, fighting on that front, and also in terms of sugar, there was recent studies in a book that Dr. David Perlmutter put out earlier this year called Drop Acid. And now we know more about I don't mean to go off on this, but the sugar has driven uric acid. And we now know that changes nitric oxide pathways in the body. So you're talking about kind of how well your arteries function, how well your hormones function, growth hormones, sex hormones, all downstream from this, from eating sugar and fructose like juice, like fruit juice, right? That's in everything. And it's also marketed as a health food. You know, eating fruit, not so bad. Your body can deal with it. It's got fiber. You can digest it slowly. But the juice, spiking insulin, you're going to store fat. And the uric acid pathway, which is something that no one except for kidney specialists dealing with gout have talked about, right? So this is a major kind of corner that a couple doctors are turning here. And Perlmutter's a neurologist, but he's also made a lot of gut-brain connections. Unbelievable how damaging, or let's put it this way. He said that this was an adaptive mechanism that allowed us to store fat because winter is coming, right? So you think of the bear that finds a lot of berries and starts spiking uric acid, insulin, and is really trying to store fat, right? They're going to go nuts, and there's a positive feedback to eat more, right? To berries, sugar, et cetera, go, go, go. But that's going to be for an animal that hibernates or historically would get us through the winter because we stored a bunch of fat. We don't have that problem, especially if you live in San Diego.
Yeah, exactly right.
It was 70 degrees here in Savannah, but it's humid. So we don't have that problem, right? In the modern age, it's getting to food and healthy food's a problem, but they can still get calories. So, you know, we're getting sugar and hitting this pathway that shuts off a lot of healthy things hormonally, causes fat storage. Has problems with the arteries. You're talking higher blood pressure, more scratchiness in the arteries, worse hormones, less growth hormone, faster aging, you know, you name it, you know. And so the uric acid test is something that people have been saying, hey, let's go do that. You know, we need to be having that done. And nobody said, oh, no, the medical establishment, no, that's for gout. Right, if you eat too much sugar or alcohol or eat sardines with certain amino acids or peanuts, that's all gout, but it's actually not. So it's how much of this sugar pathway that is making us sick, insulin pathway, do we have to unveil that has been covered up? And I just have this feeling that some of this research people have known. That's not going to be done. We're not going to study that, you know.
I think some of it's intentional. Potentially all of it is intentional. And even with the oils, I mean, they are kind of, it's a war on food. They're already committing genocide, but then arguably they've been committing genocide for decades very slowly through food that isn't actually food. And now there keep being lawsuits, I've noticed, in the last couple of years, like this bread that's advertised as a bread doesn't have any of the components of bread, for example, or, you know, even Skittles that they advertise to children, and we know that they're not good for you, but they actually contain titanium dioxide, which disrupts your DNA. Mm-hmm. So all of that is a nightmare, but there's easy ways to fix it just by growing our own food and making things, and even oils. You can make your own avocado oil. Mm-hmm. And I've never tried to make olive oil, but the avocado oil is not difficult at all.
Yeah. And you're going to be, as long as you're limiting the exposure to air, you're going to be making the best fat you can on Earth,
right.
Because it's cold, you know, hopefully cold press, you know, that you're just very, you're not generating a lot of heat and disruption.
Well, right. I don't know if I can make enough avocado oil to sell, but you know, we've got two trees and I don't know, like maybe I could just eat the avocado and eat the oil that way. You know what I mean? Like, I know that might
sure.
be a novice way of looking at it, but it's like, I don't know if I need it.
Why don't you just blend the avocado? I mean, that's what Green Goddess is. So
right,
just blend
right.
it. I mean,
yeah,
poof,
I've got two of
fiber.
Those trees. Olive. I've got one dwarf tree. I got it as a freebie. I don't even know if I assume every olive tree produces fruit, right?
Oh.
Maybe. We'll see.
Maybe, we'll see.
Maybe I'll be able to do olive oil. Who knows? We'll see. I do have one tree. No olives at this point yet, but it's still early days.
You know, the three kind of part of how to identify good olive oil?
What's that?
Number one, I like it in a can, okay? But so that's just starting off in a can because that means light's not getting into it. It's sealed. But if you buy it and it looks yellow, then it probably isn't it. Olive oil should be green, grassy, and for the most part, when you taste it, if you take a shot of it, which I actually recommend, is a fantastic thing. Try it. If you have
yep.
inflammation in your body, try a shot before you go to bed. See if you drop some weight. Is that the last one? Should it have a little bite? And those are the polyphenols. I went through a whole olive oil tasting workshop at a place that is like had olive in the name of it in Bluffton. It was a cute place, and the big strong ones have a real bite to it. Those are protective mm-hmm. polyphenols. Those are really good for you, but they're actually pretty bitter. And so you think of like chocolate has bitter polyphenols, you know. So those aren't the best tasting things. They're not like the, you know, what we've got in fruits, but they're very good for us. And so they should have all three. It should have some kind of bite afterwards. It should not be smooth, you know, like no taste. You should be tasting grass, and it should be green. Most olives are green. They are not yellow.
Yeah, that's true. I think a lot of people have a problem with teas that way too. Like they mm-hmm. don't, you know, they think that that tea should look one way and it absolutely shouldn't, you know, like people will, you know, go to the grocery store, buy a box of green tea and it comes out brown and they're like, ah, that's probably fine. I'll just add some sugar and some milk and it'll be okay. But that's not really, that's like, I've been geeking out on that lately is like learning how to like, you know, perfect temperatures for each kind of tea and, you know, what tea actually looks like versus, you know, what we've been marketed. And it really is, you know, an education, you know, in most kind of foods, trying to figure out what food is supposed to look like. I've told this story a few times, but when I first got chickens, you know, we put in all of our time and effort into this flock of chickens. They were free range, organic scraps, you know, and we finally got our first eggs and, you know, cracked them open into a frying pan and the yolks were like neon orange. And, you know, my millennial self said, well, this is wrong. Eggs aren't supposed to look like there's something wrong with my chickens.
Oh,
and so
they're loaded,
you know,
with choline and B vitamins. Yeah.
So I look it up on the Google machine, what's wrong with my eggs, right? Because millennial, you know, fully admit it. And, you know, to my surprise that's what they're supposed to look like, you know, was my kind of coming to Jesus moment as far as it, you know, as far as I don't know what food is even supposed to look like. And I wonder how many of us don't know, you know, it's been really kind of a pleasure and an honor to wake up to this kind of truth, this basic fundamental survival truth of what that people aren't, they don't know anything about even what our food is supposed to look like. And, you know, waking people up to that has been really like I said, a privilege.
Well said.
Lily,
I agree with you. Like, a lot of people don't know what food is supposed to look like. And children, when I was trying to get my teaching certificate, and this has been like a few years ago now, but even then, when you would work with elementary school children and even some middle school children and show them pictures of different fruits and vegetables, they had no idea. Like, they couldn't identify which ones were which thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a garden.
And so it's really something we need to work on.
Yeah, gardening at the school immediately changes that, right?
Yeah. And that's, I mean, whether it's South Central or, you know, South San Diego, I would say virtually every school, elementary school, has a garden.
Hmm.
You know, and that's something that I can say.
They do?
Yeah. Not when I was
That's
kid,
incredible.
But no.
I live in Nebraska, and I've never heard of a school having a garden here.
Yeah, but we live in Eden. You know what I mean? Like, there's no excuse. For you know, I mean, maybe there's some in, like I said, I'm sure there's going to be people who say, oh, yeah, there's not in this school, in this school. But, like, there's – everything is outside. You don't walk, you know, or you when you leave your classroom to go to PE, you walk outside. I know that a lot of places are all inside schools. Like, you've got, you know, inside places to play and stuff. We don't have that here because of the weather. So there it's almost you know, illogical not to have a garden, not to teach our children at least a little bit. Even like, you know, inner city schools in San Diego, when you walk by them, there's food growing up a chain link fence. Like, it's all of them, virtually all of them have, and if they don't have, should have a garden, because all you need is a tiny patch of land, and every school around here at least has one.
I would actually consider sending my children back to school there then, if they weren't doing like masks and vaccines and stuff, because here it's just, there's no point in it, you know, like I wouldn't send them for learning. I send them because we just do learning with each other, but I send them for socialization and making friends and things like that. And they've just completely destroyed all of that here, which is why I decided I wasn't going to send them back, and they didn't really want to go back. And so my oldest is doing college classes for high school, for homeschool. But it sucks, you know, because it's all online, so she doesn't really get to meet people. And then my younger two just do homeschool, because why would I send them to school when they don't get to pick their own table at lunch? They have to wear a mask all day. Like, you know, there's just no point then for me. And then they don't learn anything anymore besides that there's 2,000 genders. And so no disrespect to other people's like gender preferences or whatever, but like, I just don't feel like that's education.
Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of disruption in schools. It's phenomenal, and just disruption. Right. And teachers are kind of holding on to these classrooms. I've seen two different models before, two different places, and as a substitute before, and I could not fathom having kids in one, because at least 2/3 of the class was on the verge. 1/3 was never going to do any work, and parents were totally disengaged, and were behavioral cases. You know, we're going to get in trouble. We're doing things that kids that are focused on studies don't do. And then 1/3 were kind of wavering and could be distracted, but maybe you could get to them and get them motivated and work with them. And then 1/3 actually want to learn, but then you're in this environment of chaos in the classroom a lot. And I know that's different when a substitute, but it's also true just watching other teachers having to deal with things. You know, and if you amp that up where there's more gang recruitment and environment, there's even more noise, let's say. So these kids really don't learn a lot. So I understand not putting people in that environment, but I'm not sure what the end of the solution is. That has to change. If they're going to go someplace and learn, that has to change considerably. It doesn't work. It's not working.
My hope is that we build community homeschools. And so instead of indoctrinating our children, we are teaching them really valuable skills that we can, like, as a community, come together and agree on are important, and do it that way, so they still get to socialize. They get, like, the best of both worlds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I, you know, it's really frustrating, because in San Diego, at least, and I think LA too, they're very much into this this new reality of COVID, where there's no socialization. They would have masks on everybody if they could, you know, and I pulled mine out because of that, because San Diego was one of the first school districts that were pushing for, you know, universal vaccinations on children, on, you know, which a lot of parents at that time were like, well, what do you mean that, you know, our children aren't getting COVID, you know, and the teachers already have it and, you know, have had the vaccine or have had COVID. And, you know, why are we experimenting? Is there that, you know, they really kind of grasped that risk to benefit ratio. And, you know, so San Diego schools are not, you know, I don't recommend them. You know, I would not say to send your kids to them if they came here because of the, you know, really ridiculous rules that they're trying to and would get away with if it wasn't for those meddling parents. Honestly, I really do think that the parents are the reason that they wanted every child to have a COVID vaccine. The parents pushed back and, you know, and now we haven't had a word on the COVID vaccine as mandatory since then. I'm going to play just one more clip. I mean, we only have 20 minutes left, but it's less than 3 minutes. I was on the Clay and Buck show. Are you guys familiar with the Clay and Buck show?
No.
No.
Oh, okay. You know Rush Limbaugh, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
He died, right? Clay and Buck took over, and they, you know, and they're actually, it's really kind of a great show, but I was on this show talking about, they asked San Diego parents to call in because they were one of the first school districts to come in and say mandatory vaccinations. And so Clay and Buck said, you know, if your school district was affected by this, call in. And I did. And so I just want to play this real quick clip because, you know, it sums up what we need to do to make sure that this stuff doesn't happen to our children again. So here we go. 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back in Clay Travis, Buck Sexton Show. We are rolling through the Thursday edition of the program. Appreciate all of you hanging out with us. Encourage you to download the podcast. Make sure you don't miss a moment. You can search out my name, Clay Travis, or Buck Sexton on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, everywhere, Google Play, that you might be interested in listening to the podcast. And you'll be able to even find that just by typing in Clay or Buck, which is a good sign about the growth of the show and also probably a sign that there aren't a lot of other Clays and Bucks out there with podcasts. We got a lot of parents who want to weigh in about the idea of mandatory vaccinations for school-age children 5 to 11, which is what Dr. Scott Gottlieb said he expects to potentially be permissible. Again, if you want to go get your kid vaccinated for COVID, I think you should be able to do that. But the idea of what Gavin Newsom is doing in California and what I believe many other governors are going to do as well and try to mandate all school children get this is a major red flag and a big no for me as a parent of a 6-year-old and an 11-year-old. My kids are not getting vaccinated for COVID. I think they probably already had it, because both my wife and I have had COVID. We haven't gotten them antibody tested, but we know they're at virtually no risk from COVID, and it makes no sense to put this vaccine in their body, in my opinion. But some of you may disagree. Some of you may agree. Let's go to Danielle first up on the Clay Travis and Buck Sexton Show.
Hello. I just wanted to say that my message is very simple. We will not comply. And that is precisely the opposite of being a domestic terrorist. We're just not
Amen.
We're withdrawing consent, right? We're just taking the consent away. That has nothing to do with violence.
Thank you. Danielle, where do you live? What state?
I live in California. I'm in San Diego Unified School District.
And Danielle, can I ask you, my understanding is that first of all, Newsom said there'll be a mandate for children to get vaccinated for next fall. The vaccine hasn't even been approved for children yet, but that's for the 12 up age group, I guess, but I'm sure he'll expand that. Where do teachers fall into this? Are they finally now forced to get the shot or lose their jobs, or have they still been stalling?
Well, it's interesting. They actually are under the mandate. However, they are allowed religious exemptions where our children basically are not.
Right.
That's interesting. Thank you for the call. I mean, I think it's going to be a major challenge. And I told you, Buck, that My phone started ringing as soon as this mandate was announced.
It's almost like a big plot by the Tennessee and Texas, I don't know. It's not the tourism board, the come live here board, whoever's in charge of that,
It is the best pitch they could have.
Yeah, there's no better recruitment for moving to a red state than Gavin Newsom or Kathy Hochul in New York State.
Okay, so that's, about as succinct as we can get. And that's really how we have to look at this in the future if it ever happens again, is that, as long as we don't comply, ever since that first, hey, we're going to do this, San Diego Unified totally backed off and no mention has been made since. So, if I really do believe that if parents just come together and say, no, we're not going to do this. We're not going to let our children be test studies, then we've got a chance of surviving this. So.
Yeah, we're not going to be guinea pigs.
Exactly, and especially we're not going to let our children be guinea pigs.
I've been trying to stress that to my more politically inclined friends, and Danielle, you know who they are, that there is a boundary, and once you start messing with people's kids, there is no other issue that matters. You can maybe crime, but that is the hottest issue in this country, but hands down. And there's just no, it's not like there's a lot of debate from the parents' side. I think that, someone told me once that issues, you become an activist if it chooses you. A lot of things choose you. Like Lois Gibbs up in Love Canal, her children that played in this playground where there was waste buried below it, and we found out that it might have actually been also nuclear waste, maybe. The U.S. government also had stuff, but there were chemicals there, certainly, and kids were getting sick. That chose the mothers. And because she would always describe herself as a milk and cookies person, and she didn't even know how to type. Fast forward 8 years, and she's got the president of the United States and the governor of New York doing things and talking about, Love Canal, right? And we've heard of that. If you ever talk to Lois, she would always say, I was just I like baking cookies. I like being a housewife. I didn't want sign up for any of this, but I was forced. It was forced on me. And this is very much creating electrified activists that you don't want to mess with because there's no budge. What are they going to go home, look at their kids? They're going to fight.
Right. Exactly. And I think they're kind of relying on that. The government is, and that's why you saw that big push to call soccer moms domestic terrorists, and it was laughable. And I latched onto the laughability of that because it's like, okay, please choose me first. Please try to make me a domestic terrorist when I'm planting food on the streets and I'm trying to protect put my children. Like I said in that little clip, this is precisely the opposite of domestic terrorism. I'm protecting my body and my children's bodies. I'm not on the offensive. I'm on the defensive. I'm not attacking anybody. I'm defending myself and my children. And I think that, the fact that that's the first position that the Justice Department, took was that these parents were the domestic terrorists. It is completely laughable. And I put myself up as the first one. Please try to prosecute me as a domestic terrorism, as a domestic terrorist when I'm trying to protect my children and plant food. Please do it. Please. Because people are going to laugh, and I think they know it.
Mm. Well, sometimes in the past, they have gone after people that way, but they just don't do it in mass. And that's different here, is that they have created a mass movement. And oftentimes it can be pretty severe for those activists that have to take it. I remember guerrilla there in Syracuse, there's a movement to people grow food in their front yard. And that's a different aesthetic. There's not a lot of land, so the lots are smaller. And the housing is older, into the 40s, 20s even, some even going back into the 19th century. But, people would grow food, kale, tomatoes, front yard, right? And
yeah.
The city decided to pick one person and just bulldoze it, right? And then give him citations for code enforcement, right? So they just said code enforcement on the guy growing flowers and has some obvious pea strings and tomato things going on. It was ridiculous, but, you know.
How long ago was that?
Supposedly the mayor said, the mayor explicitly ordered it, right? So you couldn't do more.
How long ago was that?
No, that was back when I lived there. I haven't lived there since 2012. So that was like 2007, maybe 2006.
And that's actually, I guess, a scenario that's been posed to me a few times. Like, what if the city does this? You know, and I would say to that, it's like with the age of live streams, you know, look at the city live stream, the city bulldozing food, you know. Mm-hmm. Ron Finley, you know, the from the previous clip that we played, you know, I watched a kind of a deeper interview with him. And there was at one point a city easement where there was a toilet, like a remodel was done and a toilet sat, it, you know, on the front easement for years, and nobody complained. But when somebody planted food, the alarm, you know, the sirens, oh gosh, all the citations come out, right? And it really, like you said, it really, like, you know, drove the point home of how they perceived their citizens. Right. Mm-hmm. And what, they, you know, they thought of them is that, you know, you can't grow food for them, but you can, you know, keep junk on the side. You know, that's fine.
And that's the mechanism that the city would implement power is through a citation. So the point of resistance is that citation met, you know, the documentation and then the classification. That's also how you fight it, because you go back up that stream, up that tentacle, because they have to have a tentacle to reach you. Right. And sometimes you can get, if you can get to them and get the bureaucracy out of the way and go straight to the decision maker, that's where you have the most impact. And on the local level, you have the most leverage. People always want to be federal activists at the local level. It was amazing that if two or three people, we bring two or three of us into the county legislative committee room, which would hold maybe 20 people maximum, you know, and they would, six or seven legislators would sit, county legislators would sit around a table, and millions of dollars sometimes would be allocated, and they weren't even writing it down, you know, because we would want a copy of the agenda and stuff, and just two or three people in there. Sometimes there's a reporter from the paper, never a TV person, rarely.
Yeah.
You know, maybe a radio person would be sitting in there on a, you know, at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday. But you go to City Hall, and you have enormous leverage. It's right there in front of you. And what they write down, you have a right to. You can get all of that. You can get on the agenda. I'm still on the calendar from being up there. I still get the notice of the meetings. I can't somehow get off of it. But just having two or three people in the room absolutely changed the dynamic, that there's eyeballs looking at this and that we are going to comment on the press that are sitting right next to us. And then all of a sudden, just being there, all of a sudden you have credibility with the press. Because you have been part of this process. So, you know, so there's the space, and then there's also the documents that people need, can learn those skills and affect public policy. You get the most leverage in your community. Things that are distributed that affect you. The federal government has power because it's removed, because those decision makers are not in your community. Congress people have to come to your community. Everybody has a weakness. So a congressperson has to. The Senate office person has an office somewhere, right? But those are much harder things. A city council, and it doesn't take too many, especially if you like blast one of them, then they pay attention really soon, really quickly. Their priorities start changing. And that's true with jobs too, like the whole mechanism of them putting jobs to their friends. You know, that sort of thing happens too. So you'll find out, oh, wait a minute, they just authorized $3 million for this study. Who's the firm that's going to get? Oh, it's the guy that's that guy's buddy. So wait a minute.
Exactly.
You just said, well, who else gets, are you going to announce this? Is this going to be out for bid? Well, we weren't thinking about that, you know. So no bid contracts is part of that documentary process.
Yeah. In San Diego, we've got the city council. But we also have the Board of Supervisors. And, you know, and that actually holds a lot more sway than you'd think it does, especially when it came to this this COVID emergency, right? They were able to get away with a lot more because of this even sub-body. You know, you'd think the city council in San Diego would be, you know, the top, but the Board of Supervisors really seemed to have the most sway when it came to the COVID emergency. And so, you know, but really to your point, it's like these local bodies, you know, are going to be the biggest impact to day-to-day life for most people. And so if we could, I almost, you know, when I ran for Congress in 2018, you know, I'm glad I did what I did, but, you know, a very wise woman who was actually on the, lockdown left, but this is pre-lockdown left, obviously, was like, you should run for, you know, there's an unopposed seat on the Board of Supervisors. You should do that. And I was like, no, I'm going to change the world, right? But I, you know what? I could have made so much more impact on my city than, you know, than what I did running in 2018. Yeah, I got, you know, the Russian bot RT spot, you know, that was fun. But that was really like the biggest part of it. I could have made more local impact if I actually would have run for that unopposed Board of Supervisors seat, to be honest.
And you start building a bench, what I like to call a bench of leadership. And especially, you know, whether it's an organized effort through a party or whether it's simply more community oriented people, less corporate oriented people or full-time politician people's friends that are then being brought in. Any of that changes the nature of government, and you start to develop, you know, experience ruling. And I hate that, you know, people don't like that word, but it is what it is. It's like they said, which Shakespeare was it that said you can fight the power, kill the king, but then you got to sit on the throne. And that's a very hard thing to do, but it's necessary, because who decides is what politics is. It's who decides. And so if we don't occupy those spaces, somebody else does. And so if you were that supervisor, then you've built some leadership skills, and you've also garnered credibility in government. You've made connections. You've built resources. And you've had time, a bit more inside visibility on maybe how to make change, whereas before you were outside. And even if, you know, you were elected to Congress, the skill set of dealing with Congress is a whirlwind of politics moving at a very fast clip. So if you haven't had a taste of that, if you haven't, and that's the other thing about campaigns, is that politicians learn, they get better. And as the campaign gets better to win and move volunteers and raise money, they start evolving as candidates, and the electorate starts tuning them. Like, I kind of think of it in terms of harmonic tuning or a note tuning of a piano. You start tuning to be able to communicate with the electorate and facing them. Now, I'm not being Pollyannish, so that's the way most candidates are, but that's the candidate that I would like to see, and a populist candidate like yourself that cares and is facing, or electorate facing, is that you know, in that office, that process, you would transform. And in a way you would only transform if you're in that office, you know, so it is kind of a leadership growth process to win at a smaller level. It's not a smaller level, it's a local level, you know?
Right. Although I have to say that I'm out of the running for any political position at this point, at least for the next 2 years.
That's good.
Yeah. Because of board.
Take
positions.
A break.
Yep. Uh-huh. Yeah. Contractually, blah, blah, blah. But I'm certainly looking for anybody who wants to run on a local level. Maybe Lily could, although she's planning on traveling.
Silence on the other end. I don't Richard II. Yeah, maybe who was Richard II?
Was it? I think it was the one, the Shakespeare you just quoted.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Okay.
I'm rusty on it.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, she might have. She's got children, you know, and she's actually, well, you're East Coast, so you're like later than she is, but that's okay.
Yeah.
I'm so glad she came in tonight. But we're almost there. We've got about 5 minutes left. So Lily, we were actually supposed to talk about the center of the Earth stop rotating. We were supposed to talk about that.
To what? What? I knew it. What? I knew
that's
it.
Okay.
I've been dropping stuff all week. That's why. I knew
yes.
it.
Yes.
I'll harass you about it on Sunday because that's all prophecy and blue sun, blue star, Kachina, all of that. So they've measured the Schumann resonance, which is the measure kind of, you could say, of like Earth's heartbeat, right? It measures the vibrational frequency of the Earth, as well as in connection with the magnetic poles. Yes. And so arguably what occurs when the blue sun would happen to separate the third Earth, which is like the material realm, from the fifth Earth, which is more spiritually based and in tune with nature and going back to the old ways like we've been talking about, the magnetic pole shift. And that's what occurs. And so what's happened now, our scientists are freaking out all over the place because the center of the Earth at the core has stopped rotating at all, and it is just at a standstill, and now indicating that it is going to reverse the way that it rotates normally. And so that will lead to a magnetic pole shift, which is also why I'm sure you've seen the videos that are being shared kind of virally of all these animals just walking or running in big circles for days and birds flying in circles. It started with sheep, and then several other videos happened of horses, cows. There was a really cool video of wolves, just all, and they had tried with the sheep to say it was a disease. I can't remember how to pronounce what it was, but basically like a neurological disease that sometimes sheep can have, and they will like walk to their death. But that's not what this was. They usually die within the first like 5 days. And these sheep, according to the shepherd, had been walking in a circle like that for 12 days without stopping, but were showing no signs of illness or anything else. And then we've seen it, of course, I said, like with tons of other animals now. And it appears that they are trying to show us, because, you know, we're all very connected, that this magnetic shift is about to occur, and so to prepare us. And of course, we're told in all of the tribal prophecies and the Bible and other religious prophecies and spiritual texts that to not only look to the sky, but that the animals and nature will show us all of the signs before these things happen. And so that's a huge sign, and I'm so excited because it means that like final victory in the spiritual war is almost here. And so it's going to be really great. But also, we should probably be prepared to, like, take care of our own food supply for a while. Mm.
It, yeah, absolutely. There's a flip happening, and it's probably the most gradual shift that we've had. Usually these shifts come with violent Earth anomalies, but this shift is going to be more about the shift of consciousness. And,
exactly.
You know, no matter what religion you are, you know, I think that we all know that there's something that's happening, Buddhist, Christians, Muslim, Jewish, you know, no matter what you identify with spiritually, we all feel that something's coming. And, you know, I hate to ruin the end of the story, but, you know, we win in all of these cases. So whatever evils that have befallen us, we are in the exact right place and right time for this divine flip. Mm-hmm. And with that, we are at the end of our show. I love you all. Thank you so much. Please share this if you can. And we will talk to you soon. Bye.
See you later.
Love you, Daniel. Great to meet you,
Zach. Love you.
Great to meet you.